The whole issue is designed to create a conflict which cannot be solved except by some world body. They will put two or three up there for you to vote on. All belong to them. They'll even make it like they're really against each other. They'll make you believe it. They'll even throw you some trash about one of them, so maybe you won't vote for him, thinking the election's fair because that's not a moral person. And then who do you put in the White House? Most immoral person that ever lived on this planet.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 10th of June, 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre in Bristol, and at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with military-grade Ukraine psyops and COVID medical misinformation, where an estimated 60,000 Brits died unnecessarily. London media lies now all forgotten, apparently, as it's all moved on, the news agenda's moved on. Transmitter and printing press owners hell-bent on turning society into a hostile environment for readers, listeners, viewers, and particularly gypsies. London's sarin gas waffle media trying to herd tens of millions of unsuspecting Brits into World War III and into Zuckerberg's metaverse. Which one do you prefer today, folks? As the Nazis our grandparents thought they defeated in 1945 arrogantly strut up and down Whitehall instead, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Part one this week, RIP Bruce Kent, the president of CND, anti-nuke and anti-war campaigner to the end. The BBC ignore his death, even though he's such an influential anti-war figure, for the last 50 years or so. And also the Boris confidence vote. The real voice is drowned out by the BBC's inane coverage. Will you sell your soul for a permanent place to live, only for it to be taxed so you can't hand it on to your children when you die? We look again at the house building in the UK. And the World Health Organization issue a global message that dropping food on the floor picks up germs. In part two, the Finnish Prime Minister just happens to bump into the Secretary General of NATO at an innocent private social round the corner from the CIA. Yes, it's good old Bilderberg 2022. The secret rulers of the Western world are back. And where are the mass media? Oh, they're inside the same luxury hotel fortress and they are sworn to secrecy. Goes to say quite a lot about the free press here in the West, doesn't it? The British mercenaries Aidan Aslan and Sean Penn are sentenced to death in Ukraine by the People's Republic of Donetsk or Donbass. And the bankrupt brewer of Huntingdon. I keep meaning to do this piece. Hopefully this week we will do something about enclosure, witchcraft, Freemasonry and the English Civil War. And more this week on the gatekeepers. The Fifth Columnists. Actually, this the Fifth Column was what the organisation was called in the Second World War, which was going around attracting people. The Nutter Magnets. They were secretly allowed, although they were pro-Nazi, to carry on their work. They were aiding MI5 in attracting other Nazis. Those are the Fifth Column. Of course, that doesn't include UK Column. Of course, no. This week, Alex Jones, the fake Bill Cooper, another clip about him. Iranian and Russian news cancelled, first by the television cartels, the telecoms people, then by Ofcom too. And this show cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here. So, Martin, the death of Bruce Kent this week on Wednesday, aged 82, I was pretty shocked to see no mention of this. I mean, we get the death of some obscure American musician no one's ever heard of on the BBC News, but nothing to do with Bruce Kent.
I think he was a bit older than 82.
Sorry, 92.
Yes, that's what I thought. Well, we all know that news management goes on all the time. And the BBC at the moment is under the cosh of Nadine Dorries, and they are basically towing the line. There was an obituary in The Guardian by Peter Stanford, who used to be the editor of The Tablet. But, of course, he's of no interest to the general public as far as the BBC are concerned.
Well, he's of interest to the general public.
Well, he is.
Following his work.
I think in
the
previous
decades.
Era they would definitely have covered
well,
it.
Well, I think they should now.
I really think
it's a terrible omission for them to just sort of pretend that he doesn't exist. This, in a way, I think is a deep insight into the editors of the BBC these days, who this is something that we don't want to have to think about, therefore it doesn't exist.
Yes, I mean, I think what's the interesting thing here is to compare the BBC now, ignoring this particular story, and in the past where they would have felt obliged to cover it as part of their remit. And that says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. I think it says a tremendous amount about the sort of not-see attitude. Well, this is, it's not as if, you know, that it hasn't been discussed. It's just that there are people there thinking, well, or maybe it could be simply they're scrabbling around for days and days on end trying to find someone politically correct enough to do a piece about it or an obituary or something.
Well, I think it's more sinister that not mentioned at all. Oh. Yeah, I mean, they don't have to cover it in great detail. It's not that, it's of interest, but it's not of that much interest. I mean, people die all the time. But in a previous era, I think they would definitely have had it as an item on the mainstream
news. Well,
they
should now.
But they don't do it now because the Tory government. That's because.
It's because the BBC has become an arm of the Tory government. And I mean, that process started back roundabout. I mean, because I can remember growing up, the BBC being something that you actually wanted to listen to because you knew you were going to get both sides of an argument. You may not be, you know, perfect in terms of balance, but... for example, also the dramas had a political edge, didn't they? You remember Edge of Darkness in the 1980s?
Yeah.
A very sharp political edge. The BBC were prepared to face that and do it. Now it seems nothing.
Well, that's because of the success of these things, like, you know, Ken Loach's drama documentaries like Cathy Come Home and so on.
They repeated that recently, didn't they?
They did, yeah. They repeated on BBC Four, that's right.
Very, very powerful. And, of course, they're now talking about abolishing BBC Four.
Well, of course, we don't need intellectually challenging TV. What are you on about?
Is it because the BBC is a competition to people like Murdoch and Sky?
Well, it's two things. They obviously, the Murdochs and the Berlusconis and what have you, they don't like the BBC because it gives a quite well-resourced alternative to the stuff they pump out in their tabloids. And they find that very annoying because it is quite authoritative. And also the other thing, of course, from a commercial point of view, they take up a huge chunk of stuff they'd like to make money out of. They want to run Strictly Come Dancing. If the BBC runs Strictly Come Dancing, that's money that they
well,
not going to make.
Well, I'm not so sure the BBC are wise to be competing, say, for example, for football rights when there's lots of money involved, or something like Strictly when there's lots of money involved in franchising these things. That what their real strength surely has got to be balanced, fearless investigative journalism.
Yeah, but you've got to understand that the conception of the BBC is originally... put together by Wraith, is it's not just going to be a news channel. The news is authoritative.
Inform and entertain, yes.
Yes, and
sure.
Inform and entertain. And, of course, by having Strictly Come Dancing on, followed by Cathy Come Home, followed by News at 10, you actually get an audience actually looking at stuff that they wouldn't otherwise look at. It gets much bigger audiences for the news programmes. Yeah?
To misinform, to miseducate, and to make it cringeworthy with their dire state of comedy. I mean, that's where they are, it seems, in these days. It's such a pity to see. I mean, they're still doing some good stuff, like their brilliant two-part documentary last year on eugenics, the BBC. But it's the idea that you can have somebody as important as Bruce. I mean, we're going to hear from Bruce Kent in a minute, and this is an interview done by him about 6 or 8 months ago, where he talked about how he came from being quite sort of gung-ho and pro-war into the Catholic Church, and then into the peace movement, into CND, which had an absolutely enormous boost in the early 1980s. When the Americans decided they wanted to bring cruise missiles into the country, CND really took off. So what do you make of him as a figure historically?
Well, I would say in terms of the anti-nuclear movement, he's got a similar influence and stature to E.P. Thompson, the historian. And they obviously, E.P. Thompson set up the European nuclear disarm, which had a slightly different focus. It wasn't just focused on Britain. But he was, obviously, in terms of winning over what you might call radical Christian opinion, he was very powerful. And, of course, that included Quakers, not just Catholics.
Well, all sorts, I think. And it wasn't just... I mean, I can remember going on a CND march in the early 1980s in London, which was absolutely heaving. And I think this is one of the things we're... That Bruce Kent managed to achieve with all of this was that there was a tremendous amount of what was it about Crewe's that gave, because there was the Aldermaster marches, obviously, which Bruce Kent wasn't really involved in back in the 1950s, very powerful, where people went to the nuclear weapons establishment at Aldermaster. I think they marched from London, I think.
That's right.
And with thousands of people, just to say, look, these nuclear weapons are a really bad idea. We should just disarm because they would kill innocent civilians. They are an absolutely horrendous terror weapon. And at the very least, making the point to the military that they've got to think very, very carefully, and to the government, about, you know, how much public resource to devote to this. But then it was a bit of a sort of lull after the Aldermaster period. What was it about Crewe's that really, really piqued the interest of the public and got them joining CND in their droves?
Well, I mean, the Aldermaston marches were actually about British nuclear disarmament. That's another, you know, people didn't get this. They weren't calling for everybody to nuclear disarm. The call was for Britain to nuclear disarm, because we're only a small country, and what's the point of us having them? We could start a war, but we certainly couldn't finish it, so what's the point? The Americans have got them, the Russians have got them, let them sort it out. So it wasn't, in fact, as harebrained a policy as you might suggest, and there were ex-admirals and so on saying, well, yes, what's the point of wasting the money on it? If we've got money to spend on defence, let's not spend it on this, because we're never going to use them.
Well, actually, the whole policy of nuclear weapons for the Brits was very much Winston Churchill's idea, wasn't it? He was the one that was pushing it
also,
after the war.
Yeah, but also it was Clement Attlee and the Labour government who also said, Ernie Bevin said, we're going to get one of these and stick a Union Jack on it. Yeah, so that was another aspect. That was the mentality of the era.
Okay, because the development of nuclear weapons, I find quite interesting. 1940, it was this Frisham Piles memo. Over in Birmingham at Nuffield University, where they first came up with this idea, apparently, but no one had done it before, of making uranium go bang and turning it into a bomb. And there was then something called the Quebec Agreement was signed in World War II, where Winston Churchill and Roosevelt got together and decided, well, we're going to have the Americans actually develop and build this bomb, because Britain doesn't have the resources to do so. Then by the time of the end of the war had come, Martin, this is quite key really in all of this, was Winston Churchill was told, well, sorry, up yours, mate, by the Americans. We're having this. And if you want it, you know, we're not going to share all this knowledge that we've got with you. That's what we said we were doing, the Quebec Agreement. You're going to have to build it yourself. And that's when the British development of the bomb started.
Yes, and in actual fact, it might have been better if the British had just said, we don't need them. We didn't. We decided to waste money on them. Don't forget that Churchill was also in favour of nuking Russia. We now have the documents under Freedom of Information, and the Americans as well. And he was very much in favour of, let's nuke them now before they get any. And
actually,
that was the plan.
They were already developing them.
Well, so they were, because, of course, people like Klaus Fuchs and others who
and
helped...
Victor Rothschild. Let's not forget Victor Rothschild's role.
The point is that Fuchs was not somebody like Rothschild, who's an oligarch. He was an anti-Nazi activist from Germany who got involved in producing it, and he was key in passing all the information to the Soviets. They didn't catch him for ages.
I don't know if you ever read Roland Perry's book, The Fifth Man, about Victor Rothschild, but right the way through World War II and the Cold War, top secret stuff was being passed to Stalin. In fact, Roland brags in a way in the book when he talks about the idea that Stalin was getting information about the British technological developments before Winston Churchill was. It was all being copied over to Russia, and this was a major part of when Victor Rothschild, after the war, went to Stalin and said, right, we want you to vote for the creation of the State of Israel. The fact that he'd been doing all this work during the war for them was a major part of them saying yes to all that.
Yes, okay. Now, I mean, this is all a bit of ancient history, because this is all before Bruce Kent came on the scene.
That's right, I know.
So let's. I think we need to skip over to the question you asked initially, which is about Crewe's. This is because Crewe's missiles are short-range missiles. So they've got They were a new technology at the time because they flew close to the ground.
They're medium range, aren't they?
Well, they're medium range. That's right. But I mean, they're not an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Yeah. So, but the point being is that they didn't have any sort of fixed silo sites that nuked by the other side.
Yeah. So in other words, they definitely increased the possibility of a sneak attack on the Soviet Union. And of course, the Soviet Union had similar missiles. They weren't as the SS-20 was a similar range missile, but it didn't have IT technology in it at that stage. That's one
it
of the
didn't have what
proper Western IT technology. Yeah, cruise missiles are run by computers. Yeah, SS-20s are just good old fashioned rockets.
Yeah,
things.
But they are similar to the cruise, aren't they? They've got the same kind of range. They can rumble. It's like a truck, basically, a bit like a mobile launcher. The whole point of this is that you can hide one of these in, say, for example, an industrial shed somewhere.
Yeah.
And if you decide you want to have a nuclear war, you rumble it out, and hopefully that shed isn't on the enemy's target list.
That's right. Now, the point is that both sides have developed these short-range weapons. But, of course, from the US point of view, these short-range weapons are no threat at all because they're thousands of miles away on the other side of the Atlantic. So there's a basic geographical imbalance, asymmetry.
Yeah, I think they're actually classed as intermediate range, aren't they?
Because short-range is even shorter than that. Yeah. That's right. But the point is that the possibility of a nuclear war force only in Europe, which the Americans would be able to sit out, was being put in place here.
It was.
This is why there was such a huge movement against these missiles across Europe. And ultimately, of course, Gorbachev came to power and agreed to get rid of short-range missiles. And they were all got rid of until very, very recently when Donald Trump said, no, we want short-range missiles. And this is one of the major causes of the war in the Ukraine, because the Russians are saying, you are going to have to take all those short-range missiles out of Europe. And if you don't, we're going to attack the sites where those missiles are, with our conventional explosives, and then you'll have to decide whether you're going to use nuclear weapons. This is how close we are. We're as close to nuclear war as we were in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it's not happening in the Caribbean, it's happening in Ukraine. And this is what people don't realise about underlying all of this.
Well, it's interesting, I think. I find it fascinating, Victor Rothschild's role in the spreading of all the nuclear secrets that Britain was privy to, anyway, over to Stalin during the Second World War. The book, by the way, is The Fifth Man, Roland Perry, who's been interviewed on this programme probably about 2 years ago. Bless him, he's teaching at a university, he's an Australian journalist, teaching at a university in Sydney still, I believe. And but also, what about his role, Victor Rothschild again? I hate to keep using this Rothschild word, that apparently is some sort of conspiracy theory to even mention it. But he was the key person involved in destroying the BBC back in 1987. Margaret Thatcher obviously didn't like the BBC. What was happening is they were doing a balanced job in interrogating some of the naughty things that the Thatcher government had been up to. One of which was most powerful, probably, was a panorama programme called Maggie's Militant Tendency, which looked at the far-right Martin within the Tory party.
Yeah, and of course that was a red rag to a Tory bull. As far as they're concerned, the BBC isn't there to investigate their right wing for being too right wing. And of course, on the other hand, you can say, well, the Daily Mail isn't there to give Jeremy Corbyn a fair hearing, is it? And that's just, it used to be, people just regarded that as rough and tumble. But of course, increasingly, they want to control narrative.
Yeah, well, I felt really cheated having joined the BBC in 1989 to then see the whole thing being taken apart from within. And that was due to Victor Rothschild. It was him, as Marmaduke Hussey says in his biography, Chance Governs All, his autobiography, Chance Governs All. He devotes a section of that, a couple of paragraphs, to the call to get rid of the Director General, Alastair Milne, whose son, Seamus Milne, was Jeremy Corbyn's Director of Communications. He was also an excellent columnist at The Guardian, now booted out by Kath Viner, the new editor. that role was quite insidious, because Marmaduke Hussey was the chairman of the Board of Governors. He, in his biography, explains that Victor Rothschild approached him saying, can you sack the Director General of the BBC? And that was the first inkling that there was that the BBC Director General was going to be booted out. He was replaced by Michael Checkland after a few weeks or months. Michael Checkland, by the way, wasn't an editor. He wasn't a journalist, and the Director General is supposed to be the chief editorial person at the BBC to make the editorial decisions about its direction. he was replaced, Alistair Milne was replaced by an accountant, Michael Checkland, then after a few months by John Burt. Now, John Burt was just slowly but surely was bringing in the kind of commercialisation, what he called producer choice, into the BBC. And that was what was killing it off when I was there. I mean, I was watching as nepotism was filling posts. People who'd been there for years and brilliant journalists were being, excuses were being found to put them into boring jobs and, you know, very dull stuff that they were getting to do, and some of them just being simply contracts ended, never to be seen again, and that was what they called producer choice. So Victor Rothschild played an important role both in this nuclear story and in the destruction of the BBC, who still, I don't know actually, they may have in the last few minutes said something about the death of Bruce Kent, who's the chairman of CND for many years, and probably Britain's number one peace campaigner. Campaigners. I thought, though, we'd start with a look at Bruce and going back to this period of CND's big successes in the 1980s, when they had big marches in London and that sort of thing. And one of the other things that happened to the campaign for nuclear disarmament is that Michael Eavis and the Glastonbury Festival decided to embrace CND and give the profits from the festival as a donation to the campaign for nuclear disarmament, much to people like Bruce Kent's delight.
It's 10 years since the first modern Glastonbury Fair, perhaps thousands since the summer solstice was first celebrated here. But this is the first year the festival has officially had a political motive, and that motive is disarmament. This year, the profits go to the CND. Supporters of the CND may be a minority of the 40,000 rock fans here, but they're a growing active minority, for whom the American cruise missile is as much an object of contempt as the American presence in Vietnam a decade ago. Catholic priest Bruce Kent, attending his first rock festival, seemed almost bemused by the evident sympathy for the movement he leads.
Well, it's just grown enormously beyond anybody's imagination. We had about 3,000 or so members at the beginning of 1980. We now have about 21,000 national members. We had about 150 groups. We must have now 900 groups. And new members are coming in at the rate of 300 a week. It's just, it's been out of control administratively. So many people have got involved.
Most of the slogans and stickers here today have been against the cruise missile. How important has that been in the revival of CND?
Well, it's been very significant. The cruise is seen as something very sinister. It's got to be dispersed all around southern England on these great lorries, so there's a kind of eerie thing about it. You know, will you have a cruise at the back of your garden? It's an American instrument. We have no control over the cruise, and I think that is a particular source of resentment as well. And I think people just feel that there are more than enough nuclear weapons in the world. The arsenals are so enormous that we certainly don't need any more of either of our own or Americans in this island.
Well, that's true, but of course, underlying all of this was the fact that these short-range missiles actually destabilised the existing balance of power. And of course, you can't, that was clear not just in this country, but across Europe. So there's a very strong anti-nuclear movement in Germany and in Italy, for example, where the rest of the missiles were going to be placed. And the Pershing missiles in Germany created the possibility of a, you know, 2 or 3 minute attack on Moscow. Which, of course, the Russians are really fed up with this. And we nearly had, in 1983, a nuclear war because the Soviets took all this rhetoric by Thatcher and Reagan very seriously, especially the deployment of these short-range missiles, and they thought that the West was planning a first strike. We know that now because we've seen all the documents. So they were absolutely on edge. And what happened in 1983 is they thought they were under attack, and we came within minutes of annihilation. So when we marched, and I marched as you did in that era, we were absolutely right, because the history now shows that we nearly did get blown up by the stupid people who deployed those missiles.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating point. And I think this is what we still resent today with what's going on in Ukraine, is that much of what seems to be going on in Europe in terms of tensions between East and West Europe is for the benefit of the Americans.
Well, that's right. It's pretty clear what's going on now, isn't it? I mean, what's it to one of the founders of NATO said, the purpose of NATO is to keep the Germans, the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. And that's exactly what it is still doing.
Still doing, isn't it? Anyway, you were talking about 83 there. That clip from Glastonbury was 1981. We move on now to race ahead to 1985. where because of the success of the campaign for nuclear disarmament in the early 1980s, it was quite clear that the Secret Services decided they were going to investigate, infiltrate, attempt to take over the campaign for nuclear disarmament and influence them. In fact, they got some guy, one of their MI5 people, doing the accounts of CND, which is obviously quite a powerful position to be in. But who blew the whistle on that? Well, a lady called Kathy Massiter, and here she is talking to Channel 4 and Hugo Young, who went on to work at The Guardian. I know Hugo Young. But here he is talking to her, Kathy Massiter, about Bruce Kent, and actually a bit of a clip with Bruce Kent himself being shown the picture of one of the agents that MI5 had infiltrated into CND by 1985. By
1981, the peace movement had become a mass movement, mounting the biggest demonstration ever seen in Britain.
We will translate these measures of nuclear disarmament into practical action. Because it is only...
A year later, MI5's need for more inside information on CND became urgent.
I think it was perceived as more than ever necessary that we had to be able to answer very precisely whatever questions we were asked about CND and its subversive penetration, which meant that our study had to be perhaps rather closer than it certainly would have been otherwise.
How did you achieve that?
One of the means that was used was the introduction of an agent, a chap who had in fact worked for MI5 for many years, 20 or 30 years altogether, into CND headquarters.
The agent was this man, Harry Newton, a 60-year-old lecturer in trade union studies and a lifelong activist in left-wing political groups. He'd been recruited by MI5 in the 1950s, when he was a member of the Communist Party. He became treasurer of the Institute for Workers' Control, a left-wing think tank supported by prominent trade union officials like Jack Jones and Alex Kitson, and MPs such as Tony Benn. Harry Newton joined CND in 1982, and his first job for MI5 was to attend CND's annual conference.
We regarded this as very important to know as soon as possible after the conference who the new people on the National Council were, so that we could sort of make our usual breakdown of how many subversives were on it and could pass the information along to interested parties in Whitehall. After that, he became involved in CND headquarters. They have a lot of volunteers work at CND headquarters, sort of mailing things and doing odd jobs, and he simply went along and volunteered his service.
So, well, he was your eyes and ears?
Yes, I mean, that was the basic intention, yes.
So what level of information would he report to you?
What tended to come across was very general information about what was going on in CND headquarters. It was fairly low-level stuff. He was able to sort of chat to people like Bruce Kent, this sort of thing. Harry was still very caught up in the idea of the international communist conspiracy, and therefore had a bit of a tendency to see the hand of the communists everywhere. I mean, he had quite a strong opinion that that Kent might be a crypto-communist. I personally saw no other justification for this whatsoever, but that was certainly a view that he expressed.
That's something which might find its way onto Bruce Kent's MI5 file.
Yes, indeed.
We showed Bruce Kent a photograph of Harry Newton and told him that he'd been a long-standing MI5 agent who'd infiltrated CND's headquarters.
Isn't it awful? I think taxpayers ought to have a right to know what is being done with their money. Who's getting salaries for all this sort of nonsense? They come in, we can show them anything they want to see. There's no secret.
Harry Newton told MI5 that he thought you were a crypto-communist.
Really? Well, they've overpaid him in that case. I'm not a crypto-communist. I know what crypto means. I'm not a communist.
Harry Newton provided MI5 with internal CND documents and papers.
He did, on one occasion, provide a diagram of the layout of the offices. He, in fact, provided that quite off his own bat, so we hadn't asked for it.
Presumably that would make it easier if you wanted to burgle the place.
Very much so, yes. Yes.
I mean, could that be what he was thinking?
I think this is what he had in mind, yes, that one day we might want to have access to it and therefore we would need this sort of information.
Well, I mean, I knew all about that before we heard it, and of course, Bruce's death, some timely death, as it were, allows us to look at it again.
That's the point, is revisiting it. That was a programme called 2020 Vision with Kathy Massiter from Channel 4 from 1985. Things have moved on since then, though, haven't they, with the infiltration by security services, by the police, of basically pressure groups. Now, if you have a pressure group, it's likely, I mean, for example, with these climate groups, all sorts, of course. There's Palestine groups, there are Kill the Bill group, these sort of things are all likely to be infiltrated. And the thing is, where is it that the infiltration starts to turn into control?
Well, I think that's a very good question. Back in it's a rather innocent days. I mean, as Bruce Kent is saying there, anybody can come and look at our accounts. This is pretty crazy, you know. We're not a secret organisation. But, of course, it's not just about looking. You know, they used to be justified that we're looking for subversives. You know, everybody's allowed to have their opinions, but, of course, there are foreign agents, the communist conspiracy and all of that. And that was given as the excuse. But, of course, what we now know is that for many, many years, and it's not just the official intelligence services, it's unofficial groups connected with them who are not, in fact, under any kind of scrutiny, are steering Western politics. And this is what's been going on for a very long time.
We think
of Russia as a kind of controlled society.
Well, you've got your kind of Cambridge Analyticas and people like this.
Yeah, well, all of these people are linked. And in actual fact, because the whole idea of psychological warfare, information warfare, countering disinfo, this whole area of observing and controlling and directing society has blown out of all proportion since 9/11, which was, of course, an action of the deep state, the Western deep state, in order to create the conditions to, you know, radicalise this cancer even further. So we are living in, you know, surveillance capitalism with an authoritarian streak. And we were then, but we were less aware of it. We are now, and it's very, very... I mean, think of the resources that are committed to this. We claim that we can't afford public toilets in Bristol, but there's no doubt millions being spent
It's actually, there doesn't seem to be any limit on the amount of money to be spent on this, or weapons for Ukraine and that sort of thing. Anyway.
And the other thing, of course, is the integration between the intelligence services and the drugs industry, which creates a whole other source of funds for these kind of activities.
Black operations. So let's have a listen to Bruce Kent himself now, taking us through, I suppose, in a way, his career, because he started off with, as he explains here, surrounded by guns and bombs and weapons and the idea of fighting in the cadets. But then he slowly but surely worked his way through to chairing this nuclear disarmament charity.
I started off in a very warlike life. Cadet corps in school. I was an excellent bugler once when I was 14 years old, and then went on to be a proper cadet in a boarding school. And every meal I had in the big dining room, we had 8 holders of the Victoria Cross on a portrait. So we were not a peaceful lot, really. We were quite warlike, and everybody went into conscription and as I did, and it was a normal thing to do. So how on earth did I get involved in C&D, which I did? How did I get involved? Well, I was ordained as a Roman Catholic priest, and went to a parish and became the director of a youth club. I saw some nice outings that somebody called Pax Christi, I never heard of, Pax Christi had organised, and so I got some of my youth to go on these outings, pilgrimages in the summer, and it went down very well. And about a week later, a man came and said, would I mind being the chaplain to Pax Christi? Well, I thought that's pretty rapid promotion, but anyway, that's where I ended up with Pax Christi. And it wasn't until much later when I bumped into C&D. And I bumped into C&D in a very aggressive way because I was busy marrying people on the Monday morning of August the 29th, Easter Monday. And I had about six or seven brides to deal with, and they were all late. Everybody was late, and I was furious. I expected people to be on time. And I asked, why were they all late? And they said, because some lot called C and D are walking down Kensington High Street and blocking up the traffic. And I thought, who the hell does C and D think they are if they can interrupt with my weddings? So that's how my introduction to C and D. But I wore off my hostility later on when I met an absolutely marvellous Jesuit called Thomas Roberts, who wasn't very popular with the other bishops. But he said to me about nuclear weapons, he said, look here, Bruce, are you willing at some stage to press a button to kill hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians? And I said, well, no, but no one's ever put that to me. He said, well, that's what nuclear weapons are, mass killing of innocent people. Do you agree with that? I said, no. And that began my downhill slope into C&D. And I became then a chaplain or something, I've forgotten what, in C&D. But C&D in the 60s was going downhill, in the 50s was going downhill quite rapidly. It wasn't a big organisation anymore. The Vietnam War came along and took a lot of interest and so on. So it was, we had committee meetings of about seven people in a convent in Euston, and that was C&D's national figure. So the Polaris submarine was the thing that drew our focus, and I did go up to Faz Lane, to Polaris, and operated strongly up there, with taking holy water and blessing the base and exorcism, what I call the devil out of the base. Well, that didn't go down very well, I can tell you, with Catholic right-wingers. Who's he talking about a devil? So that was the early stage. And C&D took off radically in the beginning of the 80s with the cruise missile crisis and everything. And suddenly we were landed in Hyde Park facing 100,000 or at least many thousand people in Hyde Park packed out. And so that's when the C&D that I joined really flourished in a big way and spread all around the country, Wales, Scotland, all over the place. People taking direct action, people going to prison, all very heroic stuff. A lot of people involved.
Yeah, so much less so now, Martin, probably, isn't it, to say that C&D is from the 1980s, when it hit a high point with 100,000 people or so in Hyde Park.
Yeah, but also C&D was part of the Stop the War coalition, the Stop the War, C&D and the Muslim Council of Great Britain. And I think the three organisations cooperated very closely during probably the biggest demonstration ever in British history, against the war in Iraq. And I think and one of the things he mentioned there is that the Vietnam War came along in the late 60s, and those of a radical disposition thought, well, never mind stopping nuclear war, what about war? You know, because that's what leads to nuclear war. And I think the other thing, of course, was the agreement between Reagan and Gorbachev to get rid of short-range missiles and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Suddenly, was nothing to fire anymore. We're friends with the Russians, so what's the problem? But of course there is a problem, because nuclear weapons can't be disinvented, and the kind of imperialist, rapacious nature of the Western ruling class means that we're still facing nuclear annihilation.
Well, I was very privileged back in 2015 to interview Bruce live on our FM show on Bristol Community FM. And I spoke to him about these sorts of issues, including that specific thing, Martin, about whatever happened to the peace dividend after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
The whole business of renewing Trident is absolutely back to Rudyard Kipling, that we've got to be bigger and stronger than anybody else in the world. It's absolute nonsense, but that's what we're pretending to do. And, of course, nuclear weapons have no value against the people who actually do threaten us now. I mean, ISIS, who are clearly a clever and manipulating and dangerous lot, they're not worried about dying. They're going to paradise. So you can't threaten them with nuclear weapons.
What would you say to people like Rory Stewart MP and others who are saying, well, actually, the Russia now is becoming more of a threat, and actually that the nuclear weapons have kept the peace for decades because it's although you've never used it, it's a threat that you may use it that actually keeps the peace, this whole idea of mutually assured destruction?
That's what they always say. But then we've had, I don't know how many wars between states, probably 35 or 40 since the atom bombs were dropped, and lots of other civil wars as well. And both the major powers, America, United States, was totally humiliated in Vietnam, fleeing from the top of an embassy building by helicopter, and their nuclear weapons were of no significance whatever. And the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and were kicked out 2 years later. Nuclear weapons are completely irrelevant. I mean, the Argentinians had the cheek, to take the Falkland Islands, and there are we bristling with nuclear weapons. It's an illusion of security, and that's what people have to know, have to realise.
You've lived through the end of the Soviet Union, Bruce, and we were supposed to have, in the early 1990s, something called the peace dividend. Oh. But it seems like now that's slipping out of our grasp.
It's gone. The world is now spending, believe it or not, nearly, well, $1.75 trillion US dollars a year on war and weapons. It's an enormous sum of money. It's more than anything else we spend on. And yet we don't talk about it. And that's one of the problems of many of our big charitable organizations, raising money for good causes abroad. But they very rarely make the link with the military expenditure that is really draining countries. That's not true of war on want. War on want are head and shoulders above the others on that issue.
So that's Bruce Kent, who died this week, age 92, speaking to me back in 2015 on this show when we were on FM, before we got booted off by the Bristol Mafia. Final clip from Bruce Kent, though, Martin, is what he actually was contacting us to talk about that on that occasion back in 2015, which is secret terror courts. So he was very much aware that the whole sort of terrorist threat was also being used to shut down justice here in Britain.
The court system at the moment, with regard to people who are under suspicion of terrorism, is really that you could be kept in prison or under house arrest indefinitely. You can't get out of the secret court, the SIAC, Special Immigration Appeals Commission. You can't get out of that, and you don't know what you've been accused of. All that the High Court can do is can talk about the procedure wasn't proper or something, so it goes backwards and forward between them. You can't get to the Supreme Court, and until the Supreme Court has turned you down, you can't get to the European Court of Human Rights. And so I'm dealing with a chap who's been effectively in and out of prison since 2003, and without any hope of really ending the procedure and getting back home to Algeria.
So what's he been accused of?
How do I know? That's the whole point. The accusation and all the evidence with it is secret. You wouldn't believe it. I mean, I went to a public meeting and I said this the other day, and the chap at the back said, "Don't be ridiculous. This is England. It couldn't possibly happen." Well, it does happen. These people, the Special Immigration Advisory Commission, hears secret evidence and secret witnesses, and this is nobody knows what they said or who put them up to it. And it may well be, in this particular case, that it's actually the Algerian government who's done it. That's what happened in the Libyan case. When that came out, the British government had to pay a great deal of money in compensation. But nobody knows who's producing the evidence, and so you can't rebut it.
So you're saying that evidence is being produced by foreign governments, which is convicting and imprisoning people here, and nobody knows if that evidence is in any way true?
No, it's not put to anybody, and I don't know it's foreign governments. I don't know anything about it. All I know is that the tribunal is secret. Everybody in the tribunal, all the witnesses and ordinary people are asked to leave the court, and then something happens, and then you get a ruling.
So that's Bruce Kent there. Final clip with him talking about the SIAC courts, Martin. I suppose he's concerned that because of the so-called threat of terror, which largely seems to be a threat which is dished out by the NATO intelligence services, in fact, that the threat of terror, it means that we can't have justice anymore with no jury trials, no open courts and this sort of thing.
Well, that's the whole point of it, isn't it? You create a terrorist infrastructure like Al-Qaeda was created, by the Western intelligence services to fight in Afghanistan, took lots of people from Libya over there, trained by our own security services and security forces, and then supposedly went rogue in 9/11, but that's another canard, really. And of course, you then say, because of this threat, we can't stick with the tried and trusted principles of open justice. And you know how we can't do that because it's very dangerous. You saw what happened on 9/11. All those people were killed, so we can't have normal justice here. But of course, what in actual fact that does, it allows the deep state to corrupt everything, to create more terrorist attacks. What we need is independent police investigation of the intelligence services without fear or favour, and those who are guilty to be sent to prison for life, and life to mean life. Unlike in Donetsk, where you can be sentenced to death. But of course, maybe there is a case for the death penalty for terrorists inside the security forces. An example has to be set, I would say.
Do you think the Russians are actually going to execute these people, or is this just a sort of shot across the bow saying, well, actually, we've got these guys and you better prove that they weren't just mercenaries working for someone else and that they were officially working for the Ukrainian government? They have to prove that.
Well, also, I believe, I haven't looked into it because I haven't had time, they have admitted that they were involved in the abuse of civilians in Mariupol. And, of course, the Azov battalion have had their boot on the face of the people of Mariupol since 2014. And these guys are part of that. They're not just British that are going to be put on trial. A lot of these Azov battalion people are going to be put on trial in unrecognised courts, as I said on the BBC earlier. But the Ukrainians are trying Russian POWs for war crimes. So I think both sides are going to put loads of people on trial. Let's have a look at the evidence. And let's everybody go back and find out where the real truth lies, like what happened in Maidan Square in 2014, when all those demonstrators were assassinated, shot through the head by NATO snipers. And there must be people in the British military who know all about that. I want those people arrested, put on trial, and if necessary, shot.
OK, we'll be hearing a bit more later about Ukraine, no doubt. But, Martin, this week we've had some, two bits of main bits of news I'd pick out. One is the attempted, the confidence vote in Boris. And secondly, this whole idea of now fuel prices, meaning the average filling up of a tank of petrol has now gone over £100. I remember when it was less than a tenner.
This is just the beginning. Because, of course, this is all to do with the whole row about whether we're going to buy Russian oil and
but
gas.
But isn't it something more to it than I'll be thinking about this week and, churning away in my mind. And I wonder surely the whole point really is that at some point the oil is going to run out in terms of being able to actually get the oil here. If there is a war starts in the Middle East, for example, which the Israelis have been pushing for, and for years and years, I suppose, the West has been pushing back, saying, well, you can't have a war because that would be a complete disaster for our economy, which is based on oil. We need to have oil. So there's been an attempt to sort of replace all that with, we need to get electric, solar, wind power, all this sort of thing, electric cars. And the idea is that we're getting towards the point where there can be a massive Middle East war conflagration where we won't be able to get any oil here and we'll still be able to get around.
Well, the idea that we should move away from a heavy fossil fuel society, whether you're a climate change sceptic or not, we need to manage our resources far more efficiently and fairly than we do.
But we got hooked on oil back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, didn't we? Mainly the 60s, actually. It was when they closed the railways down. Suddenly, everybody started buying these cheap cars and the oil consumption went up. And I'll tell this story from time to time. There was a chap I spoke to up in the who worked as a trade unionist up in the oil fields, and he said that the reason that they got rid of the railways was because the British wouldn't finance the oil companies to build oil rigs. The Americans said, we will give you your big oil companies the finance to build those rigs, but only if you open up a domestic market in oil. And of course, to do that, they had to decide, right, we're going to do what the Nazis did, we're going to do what the Americans did, and start these autobahns, freeways, we're going to start building motorways here and close down our railway network to open up this domestic market for oil, which we've been hooked on pretty much ever since.
Yeah, and of course the problem with any of these decisions is that you'd end up with path dependency, like the QWERTY keyboard. yeah, designed to stop typewriters from sticking, but we're stuck with it. And once you've made a decision to have...
Well, I think it's probably less harmful than oil.
The QWERTY keyboard is just the quirky QWERTY keyboard. But, of course, deciding that you're going to get, you know, be dependent on foreign resources, which is what it boils down
to.
No
coal, which we've got, literally a stone's throw.
There's all kinds of implications of that. Well, who are you going to get it from, and what are they going to demand for it, and what happens when they say you can't have it?
Yeah.
This is exactly where we've reached now. Yeah. We're going to come to discuss Ukraine later, but this is not going to get any better. I've been reading some very interesting stuff on the Saker about the fact that the oil infrastructure in Europe is totally dependent on Russian oil because it's the kind of oil it is. You can't replace it with any other kind of oil because it isn't the same sort.
Not Venezuelan oil? No,
it's not the same sort. In actual fact...
Not Saudi oil?
No, because in actual fact, the way oil industry works is each individual refinery is designed for specific grades of oil and in actual fact, for specific oil. And we've actually built up an infrastructure across you, quite logically, because Russia is not very far away.
What annoys me
most
about...
You can get there in a couple few hours on a plane.
What annoys me about all this is the way they keep blaming it on the war in Ukraine. No, it's the sanctions, which were...
That's right, the Russians have not cut off oil and gas.
Not at all, no.
Even to Ukraine. They are not at war. They would say we're not at war with Ukraine. This is a special military operation, and therefore they can carry on having the gas that we supply to keep their industries going.
There's an element of masochism to this.
Well, what it does is it really helps in the short run the oil industry and the arms industry in the US, and a bonus, it smashes Germany as a manufacturing competitor. And of course, in Germany, where they're used to having quite high paying jobs in manufacturing industry, they're going to get a bit upset.
Well, I heard them on talk radio today saying, oh, it's just because there isn't the supply there. It's all just about demand and supply. No. No, you fools. We had just last month the announcement that both BP and Shell put together are now making £50 billion profit a year. I mean, they're just profiteering and price fixing.
Well, of course, and Statoil is making quite a lot of money as well, which is Norwegian state-owned oil industry, but the profits they're making are for paying for nursery schools for Norwegian children.
The Russians, because the world oil price has increased, the Russians are also making plenty of money.
That's right. They've actually got a higher they've got a foreign trade surplus, and their budget is in balance. And they are in a very strong position indeed. And all these sanctions have done is drive up the global price of oil, which means that the Russians, for selling less oil, have got more money.
You know what?
And the war is paying for itself from their point of view. I'm reminded of
Gaddafi's Libya, which was not in debt to the IMF for a single penny. Now, and the Russians are also not in debt to the IMF for a single penny.
That's right.
So maybe it's time that we did to the regime change policy to Russia that we did to Libya.
Well, that's exactly what this is all about. But unfortunately for the plotters behind all of this, the Russian military and political class, the democratic structures they have in Russia, which they're very hard won. Don't forget, in the 1990s, Boris Yeltsin shelled the Russian parliament and killed loads of people so that we could have privatization. But of course, that direction of policy has been decisively crushed in Russia, and you've now got a modern state led by very well-educated people, a very democratic structure, just a more democratic structure than in many Western countries, including this one. And because if you come to something like that late, you can not make the mistakes that the people who've been doing it for a long time are making.
Well, isn't it interesting, this privatisation shelling the Russian parliament? In a way, what's going on in Ukraine, Michael Hudson has been explaining over the last few weeks. Just a reminder of his new book, The Economist, it's called The Destiny of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism. Tremendous interview that he did with Ben Norton. I think it was on the Multipolar World podcast. But anyway, I did a shortened version of Ben's questions to him, which is about 50 minutes long, well worth a listen to. And we've been hearing that over the last 3 weeks or so. But isn't it interesting? It's, again, just like you were talking about the shelling of the Russian parliament by Yeltsin there, this is a battle between different systems, between people that want to rule by money and allow money to take everything over, and those that want a mixed economy with the state controlling the infrastructure, basically. Isn't that in a nutshell?
That is it in a nutshell. And, of course, one of the problems was in the past is that the kind of economic policies pursued in the Soviet Union and in the People's Republic of China were idiosyncratic, let's put it that way. they were anti-market policies. Whereas what you've got now is that the top economists in Russia and China are far superior to the people who run the City of London. And in actual fact, they are going to win this war, which is what it is, because in actual fact, in war, you need a plan. And their plan, they've got one, it's just rubbish.
Anyway, we had a vote this week with 40% of Conservative MPs voting to get rid of Boris Johnson, but actually only 60% saying we want to keep him. So what do you think this means for Boris, Martin?
Well, I think from the plotters' point of view, they wanted to... it's not been an orchestrated plot, yeah? They just reached the 54 and then they had to trigger it. So in a way, it's going off at half cock, which in a way it suits the Johnson government because they've survived it. The problem is that Tory leaders who get this kind of, this kind of...
It's not really a vote of confidence.
No, it's not.
40% against you, is it?
No, it's not. And lots of others who are voting for you because they can't think of anything better. The problem for the Tories is they haven't got any alternative. They don't know which direction they want to go in. They're completely at sea in this global economic and political crisis. I mean, they just think it's about getting Brexit done and getting taxes down and house prices going up. And then suddenly it's about nuclear war and banking collapse. Yeah. It's not the sort of thing they've even thought about.
Anyway, I thought it'd be interesting to hear Jacob Rees-Mogg's take on this. We don't hear very much of him around.
We hear far too much.
I don't think we do. I don't hear very much of him as a political commentator. He put his foot in it a few times, and so the Conservative Party don't seem to like to let him out.
He's definitely been told to
much.
Shut up, but he doesn't do it.
Yeah. He certainly didn't on Tuesday. This week was it? Oh no, Monday it was, where he was on Five Live chatting to them about what he thought pre the vote, which happened that evening.
I think we can now cross to the lobby, I believe, and speak to Brexit Opportunities Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg. Good afternoon.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining us on Five Live Drive. Now I understand you have just come out of this meeting of backbench MPs with the Prime Minister. What can you tell us?
Oh, well, the Prime Minister gave a very good and considered speech about both what he had done and what he was going to do. So he talked about his leadership, how he had managed to deliver Brexit, how he'd managed to get us through the pandemic and bring the West together over Ukraine, but then also to look forward about how do you deal with the cost of living crisis, how do you invigorate the economy through tax cuts, through increased home ownership. So it was both a reflective speech but also a forward-looking one.
And the atmosphere in the room?
Was very positive.
Against a backdrop, though, of this confidence vote, in just over an hour's time, we've had Jesse Norman, a Conservative MP, saying Mr. Johnson presided over a culture of casual law-breaking in Number 10, an excoriating letter that he put out on Twitter this morning. We've had John Penrose, who is the Prime Minister's anti-corruption champion, resigning as well. A barrage of criticism. Do you think he will sustain his position in light of what's going on today?
Well, I'm not sure two is a barrage. And Jesse Norman, in his letter, didn't give any answers. He didn't say how he was going to deal with the immigration crisis. He didn't manage to get to the heart of any of the matters. He just had a series of complaints, and that's not, I think, a very good way of elucidating political debate. John Penrose is my constituency neighbour and is a very admirable individual who has done good work as the anti-corruption czar, and it's a pity he's come to his conclusion, but I don't agree or share his conclusion.
When we go back, though, we were just hearing Theresa May, December 2018, she won the vote of confidence in her leadership of the Conservative Party. But you led calls for the confidence vote, saying losing the support of a third of her MPs was a terrible result for the Prime Minister. You called for her to resign. What would be the tipping point for you then, given you've already said that about Theresa May? Which number should we look for this evening, Mr. Rees-Mogg?
I recognised, and it was pointed out to me by friend and non-friend alike after I said that, that that was actually wrong, and that in a democracy one is enough, and that it was both wrong democratically and ungenerous to Lady May, as she now is. And I recognised that and accepted it. The answer is that the rules require that he wins by one, and one is enough.
So that's Jacob Rees-Mogg there, speaking on Five Live on Monday. Martin, the obviously the result was, actually, it's interesting because Rees-Mogg is there saying, well, he really does, you know, a third is enough, but actually, no, he's saying one is enough. He's changing his tune. As it happens, do you think, Will, there'll be, the election is in 2023, is that right? 2024?
Well, it 2024. Depends, because there could be an election that comes out of this chaos.
Well, look,
I've been receiving emails from the Labour Party suggesting that we could have a snap
the
election.
Labour Party is, well, they're always saying that, Martin. It's very unlikely with a massive majority like this. He's not going to
No, because don't forget that one of the things that Boris Johnson may do if he's finally facing being kicked out is he uses his last power to call a general election, because he can. Because we used to have the 5 years parliament thing, which was absolutely essential for stability. And then when it wasn't essential for stability, we got rid of it. And of course, Rees-Mogg is talking about the rules in the Conservative
Party. It's 2024. You've got another 2 years. It's not going to go because he's got a massive majority.
It depends.
It's very dangerous for an opposition to be just fantasising.
Listen, it's not fantasy. In actual fact, the Labour Party isn't ready to fight an election. Okay. So in other words, that might be a thing that make him consider about doing it.
That sounds
Don't forget, Boris Johnson is a gambler. Yeah, everything about his political career suggests. Shall I double the pot, or shall I fold?
Whichever way the wind blows, Boris blows.
Yes, but he may also conclude at some point.
It's a way to survive in politics, though, isn't it?
He's basically been given an easy ride all of his life for everything he's ever done. And now he's actually had to do a proper job for the first time. He's found it a bit of a challenge. That's the truth about him.
I don't know if he's ever had to do a proper job.
Really. Well, no, he's not. No. That's why he's finding being Prime Minister such a bit of a problem.
His unique selling point is a great blusterer. And I suppose that's exactly what you need in a modern world where actually politics isn't really in charge. Boris is certainly not in charge. Who is in charge? Well, what do you want to call them? The deep state, banks, maybe. Certainly, we got a taste of all of this last week with the Bilderberg conference back after 2 years absence. And hopefully I'm joined on the line now by Charlie Skelton, who wrote a nice little piece for The Guardian about it. Hi, Charlie, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you. You sound like you're in the bathroom there, Charlie. There's a sort of plopping sound in the background. I don't know if that was the soap just going into the bath or something.
That, Tony, was white wine.
Much better. I'm glad to hear it.
A whole bathful. Amazing.
You've obviously gone over to the dark side if you've got a bath full of white wine. Anyway, look, Charlie, can you just give us your take on what you saw this year? I noticed that... You were tweeting about this little chit-chat going on between the Finns and Jens Stoltenberg at this so-called private event, which apparently is not necessary for the press to be there and scrutinise it, even though, of course, the whole of Finland is, it looks like, now about to join NATO.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't see anything in the sense that I wasn't there, but what I saw was an extraordinary participant list and... a very different sounding agenda. I was looking at the agenda and it just seemed very sort of like, oh my God, here's the crisis. It's coming. Here we go. It's the great reset. It's the grand realignments. You know, the great chessboard's been thrown up into the air, and Bilderberg are going to kind of thrash it out. And they're doing it. They were doing it in. Right in the middle of Washington, with a huge swathe of Washington insiders and, you know, spy bosses and, you know, the usual crowd, obviously, but skewed, I think, towards Ukraine and war.
So are there any particular individuals that were there that you'd like to pick out and say, well, that's an interesting... Because, you know what, of course, you know, I've been doing this for, gosh, 25 years, I think it is now, going through these Bilderberg lists. And then we actually started off really just simply by publishing their press release, which says not for publication at the top, on back on the internet back in 1996, I think it was, the first one. And then getting a message from my internet service provider saying your website has been overwhelmed, or you know you're going to have to start paying a lot more money because there's so many people looking. And this is just literally their press releases being put up on the internet. But so if you go through the list, who would you pick out for us this year, Charlie?
Well, I'd have to say the head of the CIA, William Burns, just for not only because he's obviously a powerful individual in the US administration, but he's also he briefly appeared on the just before he took office, he briefly appeared on the Bilderberg Steering Committee and then disappeared after like a couple of months, because it, obviously it was thought. So he's that much of a Bilderberg insider. But when he took the job at the CIA, they thought, oh, that's a bit embarrassing. You're going to have to resign from that. He stands out. But, there's loads of other spy bosses. You know, the French version of MI6 boss, the DGCSE or whatever it's called, that one. The US head of cybersecurity, Jen Easterly, and the national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, but also, overseen by the national security advisor of national security advisors, Henry Kissinger, who at 99 is still going on, still there, still holding court. It's impressive.
It is. Last week, I was saying, suggesting that Kissinger's being a bit cheeky, saying that, isn't it, we're going to have peace in Ukraine, and we've got to give cede territory to the Russians in order to make peace. I'm just a little bit cynical about this, because it does seem as if he is like the one clarion voice of common sense, and everyone around seems to be cheering in the other direction, that is, cheering on Zelensky and the Ukrainians. But this whole war over there does seem to have ramped things up a bit, Charlie, doesn't it? It used to be the Middle East wars. Wars are coming a little bit closer to home. And in Eastern Europe, this is back to the Cold War now.
Yeah, and this meeting was definitely a kind of high-level NATO military summit. You know, you had the ambassador of Ukraine to the US there, and also the head of the biggest natural gas, state-owned natural gas company, something called something like Naftgas or something like that. And but to go back to Kissinger's for a second, he's just co-written a book with Eric Schmidt, the former, head of Google, and he's also on the Bilderberg Steering Committee, called The Age of AI. And Kissinger for a while now has been thinking and talking about AI. And I kind of think he's left geopolitics behind and has moved in his kind of middle age, has moved into focusing a lot on AI and tech. And because he thinks, and I think, correctly, because, the man might be insane, but he's also very clever, that that AI is the future. And if you look at Bilderberg's, the other thing that stands out from this year's Bilderberg list, apart from Ukraine and Washington, I would say is the AI again. It's another great big raft of top AI executives.
But I mean, this surely is about the departure of David Rockefeller, really. This was the age of oil he represented, and obviously he was involved in banking too. All these people pretty much are. And the bankers, it's almost like the Sauron's eye, which is the banker's eye, has swiveled away from oil, and it's now going towards the tech world.
Well, there's fewer bankers this year, definitely. And actually, fewer of the steering committee, if you sort of count them up. There's like 10 of them, 10 of the 33 odd, whatever it is, 34, whatever it is, aren't there. And it seems a bit ad hoc. It's like, on one sense, it's like, okay, it's Ukraine and it's, Finland and Sweden and all of that, but also, and NATO. But also let's hold focus on the future. And it's a lot of the big, big players in AI, OpenAI and DeepMind and that lot. And, I kind of think that partly because, as Kissinger's soul sort of wisps off into the hereafter, he's sort of, he's almost, you can tell he's in the queue for digitizing his mind. Hopefully he lives long enough that he can.
But look, I mean, this whole idea of digitizing minds itself, isn't there something a little bit absurd about this? I mean, okay, so I can remember, I think it was in the 80s, there was a sort of big splash when they said, oh, well, the chess computer has just beaten the world's greatest chess player. Well, that doesn't mean to say that artificial intelligence is going to be able to replace human minds across the planet.
Sounds like you're tiptoeing around the word soul there, Tony.
Oh, gosh. Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't, does it? I mean, it all just depends on whoever programs it as to what it does. And
never mind that. I mean, what the AI is going to do is run the post collapse surveillance nightmare society that's you know hurtling towards us. So it's all going to be run by, you know, it's all, you know, the AI can do all sorts of fun things, but it will also, you know, it will run your dystopia very efficiently.
Well, they've been talking about AI courts, haven't they? You know, making judgments about, you know, yep, whether people go to jail or not and how long they spend in jail or maybe when they get executed or not. It seems that the transhumanist elite, which Bilderberg definitely seems to be part of, have decided that, you know, we can dispense with humanity. The computers actually make a much better job of it all.
Absolutely. And the other side of it is you know, is the kind of life sciences, blood sciences thing that they're into. You know, like, but Kissinger was on the board of, what was it, Theranos? That, you know, that the thing that collapsed spectacularly, the blood science thing. You know, they're all trying to get their, you know, their,
which was a massive fraud. Elizabeth Crikey, what was her second name? Can't remember. It's just been done, hasn't she, for that?
Yeah,
And Kissinger is sitting on the board there. So fascinating that he should be endorsing something which is just the courts then dragged through as fraudulent. I mean, obviously the main focus of Bilderberg has got to be NATO. It's the NATO countries. Occasionally they have, say, a Russian there, but they're only the Russian representative for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace or something. But the significance has got to be around Ukraine and the war there. I mean, Bilderberg got very much had a lot to say about the Yugoslav conflict, for example, very much involved in NATO, and yet they put Ukraine at the bottom of the agenda. I thought this was a bit of a Mickey take, really, Charlie.
Mm, I know what you mean. I mean, the it's very interesting that Stoltenberg is there again. I mean, I remember seeing him. We had a sort of a view across during the Turin conference of whenever that was, 2018 maybe, where they had a huge tent on top of the some Agnelli building, and Stoltenberg was there delivering this speech, you know, going, you know, here's what NATO's up to, blah blah blah, a keynote speech to Bilderberg, and you know, he's still coming year after year. His father came actually to Bilderberg, you probably know. But what I was going to say is, what's interesting about that is you get these high level briefings about geopolitics, which aren't just going to politicians and policymakers. There's loads of people around, you know, sitting around the table or sitting at the keynote audience who are just ruthless Wall Street investors and run, you know, giant asset management companies and such. So it's who are definitely not there for the benefit of mankind. You know, they are representing, you know, their chairmen and CEOs of, you know, like Barroso, who's chairman of Goldman Sachs International. You know, these people are there for the benefit of their bottom line.
Well, that was quite a nice revolving door there, wasn't it, between president of the European Union and suddenly chief of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, yeah. And now chairman of Gavi, the vaccine, Global Vaccine Alliance. They kind of bristled, didn't they, at Barroso joining Goldman Sachs International, which is, you know, Goldman Sachs International is like the really bad bit of Goldman Sachs. It's like Goldman Sachs is bad, but then there's Goldman Sachs International, who are like the really scary bit. And yeah, he's head of that. But yeah, so yeah, the fact that there were loads of Portuguese there this year, I think, relatively. So I'm, you know, my money's on Portugal next year.
Oh, right, for next summer. So that would be, well, I think we should say something about this. Almost certain to be in Europe, isn't it? And I think for their return from the grave of COVID, the Bilderbergers have chosen to just go on a nice, safe outing in Washington or, you know, very, very close to the centres of intelligence power, Central Intelligence Agency, these sorts of organisations. But for them, it's a little bit of a more of a dicey adventure, isn't it, coming to Europe, Charlie? At least it should be. I think it probably is.
I think so. Yeah, and I think, you know, if I was, again, it could be Scandinavia because of, you know, the sort of Sweden and Finland thing. So Sweden, it's obviously a huge player in Bilderberg with, you know, the Wallenbergs and their money and the various Wallenberg kind of board members who turn up with them. And so Sweden, it could be Portugal. But I tell you what, if there's any bored people out there that have got nothing better to do, then start looking at block bookings of five-star hotels around late May and early June next year. And booking.com, I would suggest. And you know what? I looked at Washington. My first search this time was Washington. And I checked the, because I thought it feels like Washington. And I went to the Marriott Westfields, where it's been like three or four times. Yeah. And it wasn't there. And I just kind of lazily gave up. So that's my, you know, that's on me, that one.
Look, there's been almost no press coverage. You've gloriously managed to get The Guardian to publish your piece. And
but one is enough.
Look, it's just not, there's hardly, well, the Morning Star did something. Look, this is a gathering of some of the most powerful people, certainly the controllers of much of the wealth and military power in the Western world, Charlie. Why do you think there's so little coverage?
I mean, it's tragic. It's tragic. It's gone back to sort of, you know, 10, 15 years ago level of coverage. I mean, this year was awful. And partly, you know, I think it's maybe this time is partly a bit of kind of a hangover from COVID. People were caught on the hop. I mean, I was. Lots of people were. They didn't really think about it that much. They weren't really ready. But, you know, why isn't there the coverage? And like just that Stoltenberg tweet that he put out where he's talking to the Finnish Prime Minister, you know, talking about accession into NATO of two countries. It's a huge deal. And the fact that that's not covered at all, not even like just factually sort of name checked a bit by foreign correspondents of major newspapers and news outlets. It's bizarre. It's totally bizarre.
I mean, isn't there something sort of hardwired into the way that news works in the world, in the Western world particularly, which is, I mean, if it ain't on the wire services a few days beforehand, then it basically it doesn't exist. And I mean, what we're left doing is trying to basically pick up on it over a weekend. And the first, you know, as the papers really start moving again on the Monday, and the broadcasters get back to full staff on the Monday, the whole thing's over with.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a crazy scramble, and it just was, you know, it was sort of a meeting which is by any measure a significant meeting in the current kind of just sort of shape of geopolitics, was just met with silence and from a sort of embarrassed silence. I sort of think that the mainstream media, you know, this is my pet theory, is that they, as you say, they're just not being spoon-fed. They're not being given the press release, so they just don't really know how. They've sort of forgotten how to do journalism. Mm. You know, so they just don't do it.
Yeah, they allow stuff to be sort of fed to them, but they don't actually think for themselves very much. Well, look, the other thing, of course, there was the boss of Shell, boss of BP there. We've just, I mean, a little back of a fag packet calculation. They are now running, the pair of them together, around about £50 billion a year in profits. Quite obviously price fixing and profiteering. What do you make of this cost of living crisis? Because it seems it's all been blamed on the Ukraine war. I mean, for many of us, it's not just the you know, fuel bills, the gas price, the petrol price. It's also the rents, the mortgage rates now going up again. And it's almost as if this is all part of this great reset. What do you think? You know, the idea that, you know, we're not going to actually be able to afford anything anymore, and yet we'll be smiling.
I've had to go back into housebreaking. I mean, I thought I'd turn my back on all of that. And, you know, I've got to supplement my income somehow. But no, what I was going to say, sorry, is actually the, to go back to your BP Shell thing, is don't forget there's also a board member of BP there, Sir John Sawyers, former head of MI6. And also got the chairman and CEO of Total, Patrick Poyane. And also another board member of Total, Barbazet.
Yeah, they're French, aren't they?
Yeah, Patricia Barber's there, and she's on the board of Bilderberg. So yeah, the oil companies are very well represented there, and I'm certainly not qualified to talk about the cost of living crisis, except that I'm getting my coffee in now because I have a sense that that's going to go up.
Okay, yeah, but I mean, seriously though, this is all very, very close to Schwab and the WEF, isn't it? The idea being that, wasn't Schwab on the Bilderberg Steering Committee himself for a while? Certainly, he attended quite a lot. And it's the timing as well. So the World Economic Forum closes, Bilderberg starts. It's almost as if this is the real deal. The WEF is a talking shop where people are allowed to say X, Y, and Z, scripted to say whatever it is, and then the meeting gets together where the real and also you've also got the Bilderbergers doing this thing where over the I don't know if you still think this is one of the things they do, which is just to be sort of schmoozing with some of the potential leaders of, say, opposition parties that might make it ahead. I mean, we've seen Tom Tugendhat there this year for the Tories. We've seen also David Lammy for the Labour Party. It does seem to be a place where people are sort of the magic wand of power is waved over their heads, and in later years they then go to greater things.
Totally, it's a massive schmooze, and it's just to go back to the World Economic Forum. You've got They're absolutely intertwined, Bilderberg and the World Economic Forum. And some interesting journalism has been done on Schwab's relationship with Kissinger, which goes back to Harvard really, really early. But they haven't quite, it seems like they haven't quite nailed down exactly how Schwab was kind of, as it were, recruited into the elite by Kissinger, which clearly happened. But also this year, there's three World Economic Forum trustees attending. So there's Mark Carney, who is vice chair of some giant asset management thing, and Thomas Birbal, I think, of AXA. I say of AXA, he's the CEO. And also Chrystia Freeland, who's, when we're talking about Ukraine, obviously we should name check her, because, you know, she's one of the architects of this.
What about the politicians, though? The idea that by going down the list, you could find out who's going to get promotion within their particular political parties, and possibly even become leaders, like we had, or presidential candidates, or whatever. Like we had Clinton, Blair in the 1990s. Suddenly, you know, they're nobody. Basically, they pop up at Bilderberg, and suddenly there's a sort of they appear at the top table. What do you make of this? Because it does sort of, it's almost as if the BBC and the rest of them are ignoring this on purpose, because they know that actually most of the time what they're talking about is total guff and nonsense, and this is what it's really all about, the Bilderbergers.
Yeah, and it's not just that people get kind of brought in and sort of shaken down and to see if they, you know, see if they shape up for high office, but you know, you also get deals done clearly, because if you look at some of the incredible interlinking of companies at Bilderberg, like people will join the board of, you know, like one Bilderberger will join the board of another company, another Bilderberger's company all the time. Like, just, I mean, I'm just off the top of my head, KKR, run by Henry Kravis, who's there every year, because it's co-run by his wife. They just bought out Axel Springer, or bought a huge chunk of it, and that's, you know, Matthias Döpfner, who's on the steering committee. And then Matthias Döpfner had Alex Karp, who runs Palantir, on the board of Axel Springer for a bit, but then he left. You know what I mean? They just sort of move around, but it's all utterly interwoven. So when people, you know, put up on social media those kind of dreadfully complicated web of things, you know, with lines pointing to lines, but that's because it is dreadfully complicated, and lines do, you know, there are all sorts of lines between different companies and different people and different organizations.
Well, I wonder about that. I think actually there's not that many people in charge. It's a handful of people screwing the world up for the rest of us.
Well, maybe. Yeah, I mean, you know, but there's still those kind of systemically linked companies and such. So I don't know.
Anyway, okay, so just finally on the Nazi aspect of all of this, because this is something that really got me going back in the 90s, picking up Prince Bernhard's biography and seeing this, well, basically it's about a sentence somewhere in deep in his biography saying, well, yes, actually I was a member of the SS. And because I'd read various things saying, you know, this all this stuff about it being a Nazi organisation is just some sort of bizarre anti-Semitic smear, blah, blah. But actually it does look, well, I mean, it's quite clear that he was an SS officer before he went to marry the Queen of the Netherlands. And then, but here is Prince Bernhard, who was chairing the Bilderberg for the first 20 years. More importantly, in some ways, there was the work which was done by Manfred Petrisch, who would be so, I think, so much missed as an amazing guy, really, looking at all this stuff from afar and explaining to us that actually there's far more Nazis. I mean, that is specifically people who were involved in the Second World War for the, you know, for operators for the Nazi Party. But anyway, what do you make of this Nazi connection right from the very start, Charlie?
But I mean, it's not just Bilderberg; it's across loads of organisations. You know, with obviously, you know, Paperclip and what have you. But I think it's very interesting that it's one of the big notes of how Bilderberg was formed, was in that kind of, with all of the, you know, the kind of Nazis and the kind of Nazi friendly intelligence officials, but also, you know, and you know, US and British intelligence getting together and making, you know, bringing this thing into existence. It's, you know, I think you're absolutely right to keep talking about it, because it doesn't get talked about, obviously, almost at all, because it's a very odd and inconvenient bit of history. You know, I applaud you for keeping banging that drum, because, you know, it's still relevant, that kind of, even if it's just at the level of kind of moral vacuity, it's still relevant.
Yeah, Manfred pointed out that before he died last year, that there were three particularly interesting characters at the very first Bilderberg meeting back in 1954. One was Dr. Paul Leverkuhn. He was one of the lawyers defending people at Nuremberg, a banker. He was at the first Bilderberg meeting, and so he was also a candidate and a politician straight after the war. In West Germany, a guy called Kurt George Kissinger, very similar to Henry's name. He was part of the propaganda ministry right the way through the Second World War, and obviously Nazi Party member. He was deputy head of broadcasting at the foreign ministry, at von Ribbentrop's foreign ministry, answering to Joseph Goebbels through the war. Deutsche Bank director Hermann Joseph Abs, he was there too as well. Spent most of the time between 1938 and 1945 as in charge of seizing Jewish assets. He was arrested in 1946 for war crimes, and yet these three characters were all there at the first Bilderberg meeting, 1954. The point I suppose I'm making here, Charlie, is a bit like now. The attendees of the first Bilderberg conference, like Hugh Gateschall, who was the leader of the Labour Party at the time, they were all told, none of these people were Nazis. They were just part of the German society, and it was really a kind of cover story that was dreamt up for each of them. It's only literally by the work of people like Manfred and all this time later, whatever it is, 80 years later or something ridiculous, no, 70, isn't it, that we now know that these people at the first conference were not, you know, your average German. They were actually deeply involved in the whole Nazi program in the war.
Yeah, and on the subject of Manfred, I just, you know, it's very sad, and I just want to say that I remember in 2010, so this is the second time that I went in Sitges. We you know, Hannah and I made did a kind of rudimentary press center, and then the next year in Switzerland, Manfred came in, you know, and had a proper press center with like computers and you know, you could hot desk, and you know, he made it happen. He was an incredible guy, and it's, yeah, he's he's sorely missed. But you know, look, I mean, you know about the Nazi stuff much more than I do. Just to tip my digital hat to Manfred.
Well, definitely, yeah. I mean, I think for me, this is what got me going, I suppose, about Bilderberg back in the 1990s was this is basically a little Nazi operation under the cover of, respectability. And it certainly was for the first 20 years. And I suppose I ought to just briefly plug my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, which looks at the connections between the British and the Nazis at the end of the Second World War, but actually during the war, where we were working with very closely with Martin Bormann, who was Adolf Hitler's private secretary, Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill's private secretary, to make sure that we got all the loot in the person of Martin Bormann, who was the signatory to all the bank accounts of the loot from Nazi Germany over here in the UK. And this whole idea, I mean, maybe we can finish with this, Charlie, this whole idea of a Fourth Reich, that is to say a kind of financial empire, which was financed from money laundered from the Second World War through Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm, and then into these corporations, even having the cheek to use Jewish chairs of some of these companies in order to kind of camouflage the fact that they were actually financed by Nazi money. This whole idea of a kind of financial Fourth Reich today.
And I think it's worth pointing out as well that there's a lot of, you know, big old money still swirling around Bilderberg. You know, you've got the Wallenberg billions. You've got the Agnellis, although the Elkans just left the steering committee. But you've also got, you know, Victor Halberstadt, who was an advisor to the Dutch royals. And he's still sort of running the show in the background. But, you've still got big blocks of you know, pre-war, First World War money is still there. It's still holding sway over Bilderberg. And, you know, that's another, it's not just AI and it's not just, who's the latest Washington spy chief or whatever, blah, blah. It's also, you know, big blocks of serious money that are still holding an important power block in this inner circle of power.
Okay, so we're going to get ready for next year. What do you say? We're going to just check hotels across Europe, you reckon Scandinavia, possibly Portugal. Any other guesses as to where we've got to be scrying when it comes to next spring to make sure that we're a little bit ahead of the game? And maybe the newspapers over the weekend that they meet haven't got the excuse to say, oh, we didn't know anything about this.
No, but it could be, just look at the steering committee. It'll be one of those countries. Like, whoever's represented on the steering committee, it can't be a country that isn't represented on the steering committee. So, and it's, you know, and it's almost certainly not North America, because they've never ever gone twice to America, you know, in a row. Just have a, come on, guys, have a start. Just like, honestly, I was talking to Hannah yesterday and saying, you know, if we just sat down, like, we could probably find it in a day if we just went through the bookings. So, yeah, it wouldn't take that long.
Yeah, that's definitely...
It's definitely five-star, and it's got a conference facility.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely do that next week. Maybe, in the absence of anything else, we can coordinate it on the good old Bilderberg forum at bilderberg.org. Hopefully we'll track these people down, the people who are actually really, 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 really running things. And it so frustrates me to see all this stuff in the London press all the time, whether it's newspapers, apart from a few exceptions that Charlie's managed to do there, and the Morning Star, where they're talking about politics. These are the people who are really deciding our futures, folks. Anyway, Charlie Skelton, thanks ever so much for joining us. I wonder if there's any particular site you want to plug, or places where people can follow your work.
Well, I mean, really only, well, every blue moon, The Guardian, but yeah, on Twitter it's Deyouk, DeyOok. But and I'll probably do some tweets about trying to find this hotel, because one thing we did learn for sure that it booked 18 months in advance, so we know that the booking's been made. So let's find it.
Okay. Charlie Skelton, thanks very much for joining us. Martin, what do you make of what you've heard there about? I mean, particularly so many spooks at this event. I mean, it's almost as if this is where the spooks tell the CEOs of the big companies and the politicians what is possible and what isn't.
Well, it may be that events, dear boy, events outside Bilderberg shapes who gets invited and the balance of power within Bilderberg. So, you know, there's clearly lots of things going on which are going to shake up the balance of power between different elements of the establishment. And, of course, we're moving into war territory where, you know, the lower level money makers are going to be, you know, told that in actual fact this and that and the other is going on.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the Russians have now decided that they're taking on the EU and the Americans in Europe. That this is almost a battle between Russia and the Bilderbergs, because they represent the political lobby of the NATO countries.
Well, I'm quite sure that the Russian intelligence services are very well aware of all the things we've been chatting about, and no doubt have far better information than we've got. They know how the Western system works, because they've analysed it for, you know, extensively for donkey's years. Their own system is, you know, is as a parallel system. They have to organise their own version of it as well. They understand how these things are done.
What do you make of the question I put to Charlie, though, about this financial Fourth Reich? I mean, I've certainly done a reasonable amount in tracing the money trail from the looted wealth of Europe in World War II to a kind of financial Fourth Reich. That is to say, Bormann's 750 companies that he created after the war invested in that. In those companies, the money from Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, and with the collusion of the British, actually, with the collusion of Desmond Morton and Winston Churchill.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, obviously, these things, you know, they took the money out of Germany, if you remember, if you believe Paul Manning's book, Bormann.
Nazi in exile.
They took the money out until they were sure they'd stabilised West Germany, as it then was, and then they brought the money back in. And, of course, that was the marriage.
And mostly in Switzerland and Argentina.
Yeah, so in other words, that was the marriage between the post-Nazis and the up-and-coming Anglo-Americans in one big, you know, crypto-fascist organisation. But underlying all of this, don't forget that what the Americans and the British have just done is they've seized all of Russia's foreign assets, 300 billion on one count, 600 billion on another count, and they've just said you're not going to get your money back. Now, that is actually a huge amount of money, but it's only money. And what the Russians are doing is they're saying, right, there's actually about that much stuff invested in our, you know, we've got physical stuff in Russia, which is about as much as that, and we're just going to take it. So McDonald's, who've pulled out of Russia, all of their local outlets have been taken over, and they're going to set up something called Uncle Vanya's, which will take over all of those outlets.
They should call it Che Guevara, shouldn't they?
Well, I think that's Zelensky just needs the beret to be Che Guevara, doesn't he? This is all about the manipulations. You know, Marshal Zhukov, maybe. I don't know. But, I mean, this is unprecedented. Even during World War One and World War Two. That kind of thing didn't happen.
It's interesting in two ways. It's as if the Western oligarchy are committing suicide on our behalf. One is by destroying any confidence in the Western financial system. And two, it's by cutting off all supplies that we desperately need in order to actually have a society. But the agenda, it seems to me, at the end of all of this, is that we are going to be plunged, not just into national debt, but many individuals are going to be plunged into debt, Martin, aren't they?
Well, developing countries over the summer are going to go bankrupt like a string of dominoes. And as Michael Hudson points out in his stuff, they've got to decide whether they're going to pay their dollar-denominated debts or whether they're just going to repudiate them. And I think, because of what's happened, it's quite likely some big country in Latin America, for example, is just going to repudiate its dollar-denominated debts. And, of course, that means that the Western banking system will collapse.
Give them ideas, Martin.
These developing countries need to do that. That's exactly what they need to do. But what that then leads to is people in Britain go to the ATM and there's no money in it. And then, of course, we have a state of emergency because we're going to war with Russia. And you can see where this is. This will happen very, very. It'll happen slowly at first, but when it starts happening, it will happen quickly. And then suddenly people will wake up and we'll be in a different
world.
Can
you just take us through that scenario again? The idea really is that you haven't got any money and suddenly the government is trying to recruit you to fight a war for them.
Well, they won't. It's not that they're going to come round and put a gun in your hand. It's more that the society will be militarised in terms of organised, you know, like COVID, if you like, but on a bigger scale. And the question is which societies are going to be able to manage this in an effective way and which are just going to fall apart.
Well, thankfully, Boris Johnson is still in charge if something like that does happen.
We've got nothing to worry about.
Nothing at all to worry about. So anyway, let's have a listen back again now to some more coverage of the confidence vote on Monday from College Green. But have a little listen in the background as well to what the BBC journalist is saying. And there's a certain voice seems to pipe up in the background.
OK, we're just going to move along the way a bit. There's lots of people milling around here, lots of different voices talking about many different things, as you can probably hear in the background, voicing their political views, as is their right in a democracy. We're seeing democracy in action this evening. We had a Tory MP, Jesse Norman, saying in a letter that he submitted, and he put it out on social media this morning, saying Boris Johnson presided over a culture of casual law-breaking in number 10. He went on to say, to describe yourself, referring to the Prime Minister, as vindicated by the Sue Gray report is grotesque. It seems that lots of people do not want to move on, and lots of Tory MPs don't want to move on because their constituents are saying they can't move on.
Well, I think a lot of people would be unhappy if they were fined for what the Prime Minister was fined for, and he said he was very surprised himself. But of course, he held his hands up, he accepted responsibility, he showed leadership for it, and of course, a lot of those things in the Sue Gray report weren't the Prime Minister himself. It's about the culture there, and it's right.
So I found myself actually trying to listen to what the guy on the megaphone was saying rather than the BBC commentary. See if you can do the same.
And who leads that culture? That's the question.
Well, and this is the point he's addressed and why I think he was right to apologise. But also, going back to, you mentioned the Jesse Norman letter, you know, if you knock on the doors in Bassett Law, they'll talk about things that were referenced like the Rwanda plan. My constituents are very much in favour of that. Things like Channel 4 being sold off, you know, I don't think they're really that bothered about that at the moment. They're more bothered about their energy bills. So I think there's a lot of other things in that letter shows maybe some of the discontent isn't all about Partygate. Actually, there's a few maybe personal issues in there as well.
Listen, let's bring in Leon Emirali. We're going to walk away because you can probably hear the man on the loudspeaker has just, you know, like bees to a honeypot. As soon as a microphone goes live, he seems to manage to find it. Let's walk and talk. Leon Emirali, former aide to Steve Barclay. Now, Steve obviously has been a very vocal critic of the Prime Minister.
So, okay, so that I was guessing, and I got my guess right. I called Piers Corbyn and said, well, what were you saying? I was trying to listen to you on your megaphone, Piers. Anyway, so let's have a listen now. This is about 10 minutes long or so. This was a conversation I had with Piers Corbyn the day after, asking him what he'd been saying on the megaphone as the decision was being made by the Conservative MPs as to whether to vote yes or no in the confidence vote over Boris Johnson and whether he's the best person in the Tory party to take us forward over the next couple of years and into the next general election.
I'm Piers Corbyn, the leader of Let the UK Live, campaign organisation and political party. And between 5 and 6, I was outside the grassed area of College Green, which is that place just outside Parliament where the mainstream media go to interview people when there's some big crisis happening. So I got my megaphone and posed a few questions and comments to them, and they could all hear me pretty clearly, and none of them said anything. I said, well, look, we all know what's going to happen. We know that Boris is going to get re-elected narrowly and will carry on as a lame duck. And you people have been actually reporting the truth about Boris and politicians and generally running down politicians, deservedly so. But, of course, there's plenty of other things where you don't portray the truth, such as man-made climate change, which doesn't exist, and also the pandemic, where you've just been reporting pure lies. So why is it that you are reporting the truth on this and lies on other things?
Well, you could kind of pick up a few words in between what the yes. was it Sarah Montague or somebody was saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was saying, oh, there's someone has very annoyingly started with a megaphone, so we're going to have to move away and that sort of thing. I kept hearing the word BBC, BBC. What was it about the BBC you were trying to tell
people? Well, I said in particular the BBC is generally the fountainhead of these lies, and I called upon BBC journalists to actually speak the truth. And I posed the question, I said, well, I know why your reply to this straight away as I'm speaking is no, that you will carry on propagating falsity. And then I said, look, the reason why you are propagating actually the truth about Boris is because the New World tyranny wants this. They want disorder. They want chaos. They want a lame duck prime minister so that they can step in with some justification, they hope, to impose a new world order from the chaos. And then I also said that this is what happened in pre-war Germany. There was a great wave of nihilistic hate against corrupt and incompetent politicians, and Hitler came forth to bring order to the chaos. You know, said they have to look at their souls or words to that effect and speak the truth on everything.
Yeah, it would have been nice if the BBC could have actually interviewed you rather than walking away and interviewing someone very boring who was coming up with, well, they know what side their bread is buttered, Piers, don't they? They just say what they are supposed to say.
Exactly what I said. And I did an interview later with Street Mike where I probably did mention it in the speech I made to the assembled BBC and others. I said that the Tory party is the most sophisticated electorate in the world, and it's very likely that this vote was brought on by Boris's mates so that they could have the vote now and get him as a limping forward prime minister, as opposed to waiting till after the 23rd of June when the Tories are likely to be trounced.
Well, they also said it's important, Piers, to draw a line under this whole Partygate business, that this has successfully done that finally. So you can see from the Tory party's point of view, they wanted to do that.
Oh, yeah, of course. But I think it was brought on now, but probably by Boris's mates, as opposed to, you know, those who want him to go. So, you see, on the 1920 coup committee, anyone can write a letter, you see. So he's probably got a big stack of them ready to write in saying, you know, I want a no confidence vote. But it doesn't mean they have to vote for the no confidence vote, does it, when it comes, you know.
Well, what do you say to people that say, well, actually, the best thing the Labour Party can have is Boris as Prime Minister? It gives them a better chance of winning in the next election.
Well, it does. And, of course, the New World Order, World Economic Forum, would certainly do their bidding quietly and probably give away more rights than Boris would. Well, I don't know if he'd give away more or not, but certainly he's not going to be worse. So, you know, it's kind of true what you say, yes. But the other Tories are also, you know, well, they're so boring. Then it would be boredom versus boredom, wouldn't it, an election?
Well, look, you just mentioned the World Economic Forum. That was last week, followed by the Bilderbergers last weekend.
Well, I think it's clear that the World Economic Forum wields more power than governments around the world. And the governments are complying with their wishes. You can see what exactly is going on in the World Health Organization, which obviously is essentially dominated by the World Economic Forum, where they had that discussion last week to impose powers over national governments in the name of a pandemic even a national crisis, which would be proclaimed by the Director General of the World Health Organization. And you see, this then is a recipe for actually one world government, with the World Economic Forum behind it all.
Well, this is quite worrying. Is this actually now in force? Because surely the governments have to vote these things in internationally. But I noticed another thing, which many people don't realise, is that if it's a treaty, then the government just itself can sign it without it having to necessarily have a parliamentary vote on it.
Well, I think that's true, yes, because treaties after wars and so on have to be signed quickly, don't they? So that's their justification. Well, yes, what happened at the World Health Assembly, which is when they have them all together to run the World Health Organization, is that Africa and Brazil and some other countries refused to accept the amendments which were put forward by the Americans. But that didn't drop it all. What happened is the committee that deals with these amendments said it was told to go away and come back in the 77th Congress. This was the 75th we just had. So it's either next year or the year after they're going to come back with some more adjusted things with the same purpose, you see. African countries are sort of mumbling, oh, yes, we can do it ourselves. So they're probably going to come up with compliance with what the new world order wants, but dressed up as some Africanization. But there's a lot of things to be done, because you're right, there's meant to be a 6 month discussion time in every country on these measures. So, we're going to ask Sajid Javid, where is this gone? Because we should have that, whether or not, this thing is as imminent as it was going to be. And we have there is a petition out there which has already got 100,000 signatures to say, which says Parliament, it is the petition to Parliament that they've got 100,000 signatures, so it must be discussed. We want it to get to 1 million. What the petition just says is there should be no changing of the World Health Organization rules without a referendum in the United Kingdom.
Well, look, I mean, it's obviously a bit of a battle going on internationally between the globalists people that want to, you know, don't want to cede sovereignty to an all-powerful, particularly if it's unelected, body, a bit like what happened with the European Union. You know, we don't want an unelected Ursula von der Leyen and her friends in control of the whole of the hundreds of millions of people in Europe without being able to elect these people. How do you think that whole struggle is going across the world? Because we've also now got this war brewing up in Ukraine, and potentially a wider war between NATO and Russia. Now, that, you know, that also is another thing which is rather, it's getting all a little bit too close to home, Piers, isn't it?
Maybe a war somewhere, or it may not be, but the purpose of it is not the war being you're told about. The purpose is to control the population, put them into a state of fear or compliance with some measures which are deemed to be necessary because of the war effort, you see. And that is what is going on. The Ukraine, though, you say, I don't know what the West assessed the Russian forces were, but they want the Russians to be bound down just in a continuous war like in Afghanistan. But I think the Russians have probably been more powerful than the West thought, because it looks like they are going to take over what they wanted, namely the East and in the South. And then the West will have to negotiate. But the key thing is going to be resistance on the ground in every country. And there's a lot of big things going on. You see, I think the Ukraine is a defeat for the World Economic Forum, which is a good thing, but it won't stop them finding another war. Perhaps the war on terror will get switched on again. I mean, who knows? We've got stuff going on in the Punjab and Kashmir, where, you know, the millions of people are fighting for independence from the Indian superstate. And if that crumbles, the Indian superstate crumbles, which is the third biggest economy, that'll be a big blow to the New World Order, I would say. Depends what comes out, but I mean, if the Punjabis get their independence, you know, you have a new state there or something, that would certainly be, that would improve the food production in the world and so forth, you know. Every country has got different things going on, but we still have a certain amount of communication between people, so people do realise what's happening. And I think, when they see that we're having big demonstrations in London, I think that does encourage people around the world to to stand up, and what's happening in Punjab does also encourage us to stand
up. I mean, it's a bit of a cheeky question, but your brother, you know, he was a major figure on the world scene as the leader of the opposition, actually leading an opposition, as opposed to Keir Starmer, who seems to be actually leading the Blairite wing of the Tory party in opposition. But anyway, what's happening with Jeremy these days? Is he completely retired or what?
Well, no, he isn't retired. He's hoping to somehow get back into the Labour Party to stand as the MP for Islington North next time. But that's extremely difficult because, you know, he could various options there. I mean, I would say Islington North Labour Party would adopt him. But then the party centrally could disband Islington North Labour Party or something like that, you see. And all that just depends on the support.
But I thought he was suspended from the Labour Party, so surely he can't stand as a Labour candidate, can he?
No, he's suspended from the Parliamentary Labour Party, but he's still paying his dues, you see. So it's not a simple question.
No, it's not, is it? And I mean, it's interesting. I find it fascinating because I know a similar sort of thing happened with Ken Livingstone when he was stopped from standing as mayor of London, but then he stood as an independent candidate, and it was quite clear he was going to do so well that the Labour Party had to re-embrace him.
That's right. That's right. And I was part of the campaign inside the Labour Party, where you know, big sections of the party locally and well all around London, they were saying, "Yeah, well." We want Ken. The alternatives they're put forward are just stupid, you know. So, not that they were necessarily bad people; they were just it wasn't going to work. So people wanted Ken.
Anyway, how do people follow you online and your political party and that sort of thing, Piers?
Come to lettheuklive.com, and you can donate there, give money, join, read about what's going on, and also stopnewnormal.net. Which is also part of LetTheUKLive.com, but that's where most of the news and events are advertised to.
And I think you do stuff up at Speaker's Corner quite a bit, don't you?
We do. Every Sunday, I'm there 3:30 onwards with Haiku Koo.
Piers Corbyn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony, as always.
So, yes, Piers Corbyn there, who was indeed on the megaphone in the background as Five Live were broadcasting their coverage, alleged coverage of the vote of confidence in Boris Johnson on Monday. It's lots you could pick up maybe from that, Martin, but what about this whole climate business? Because Piers Corbyn has put himself out as the main, one of the main protagonists of the idea that actually this whole man-made climate change thing is a scam.
There is a wide spectrum of views on this. The Green Party obviously don't agree with that. I find it, you know, I'm an agnostic about it. I'm more worried about nuclear war, what we were discussing about Bruce Kent earlier. Let's put it that way.
Okay. And he's also there talking, I suppose, about this idea of a new world order, which is, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, there is obviously an attempt by the deep state, represented by the kind of people who go to Bilderberg, to, you know, the project for a new American century. It was pretty clear what their aspirations are. But there isn't, it's not something that's just, all of these things are contested. Yeah. Wars are not just about controlling your own population.
Well, I know John Ronson's talked about the Bilderbergers as the secret rulers of the world, but he's a comedian. He was saying that as an exaggeration. They're certainly not in command of the world, are they?
No, and we could be hit by an asteroid tomorrow, like the dinosaurs, and all that would be, and the whole, all of the debate would be rather pointless, wouldn't it? What we've actually got is the real danger of the most horrible war in human history. That's the real danger. And worrying about there's going to be a totalitarian state and the war is just a way of trying to get people into line. People take fiction like 1984 as if it was political prediction. The real problem with World War III is, as Einstein said, World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones.
Well, Piers is talking also about the Punjab there, saying that there's all these little things brewing up around the world that aren't really getting much attention at all.
Well, in actual fact, as you know, all of these conflicts all over the world have specific, unique features. There's Armenia versus Azerbaijan. there's been more unrest in Kazakhstan. Kashmir is probably more important than the Punjab because they should have been given a referendum in 1948, but they weren't. There's actually a rapprochement emerging between Imran Khan's Pakistan and India because neither of them are putting sanctions on Russia. Very interesting to see that the only people putting sanctions on Russia are in Europe. Nobody else is interested. They've just called this meeting of the Americas in Los Angeles, and Mexico and other big countries are refusing to
go.
Yes,
that's right. It's been boycotted, hasn't
yes.
it?
So in other words, what's actually happening is,
this reminds
my, in
me
my
very
view,
much of what Alex Craner was saying the other week about the Saudis refusing to pick up the phone from Biden.
Yes. So in other words, what's going on is all of these things are coming to a head in a very uncontrolled way. And the danger isn't that the Bilderberg mind controllers are going to turn us all into little robots. The danger is that we're going to just incinerate ourselves. And as I said earlier when we were talking about Bruce Kent, we nearly did it in 1983. The facts are all there. It was only because the Russian guy on charge on the very evening that it happened didn't press the button, which he was ordered. If he'd followed his standing orders, we wouldn't be here. Well, and that's how close we came.
It was, I think, I'm not sure if it was the 1980s or the 60s, but anyway, if you want to know, have a look at John Pilger's film, The Coming War on China. Absolutely brilliant, shown on ITV, amazingly, one evening, not just on the internet, but they there talk about a order which was sent by the United States Strategic Air Command to the commander of the ballistic missile force in the Pacific, saying launch the force at China. And the guy just simply said, well, hang on, we're not at war with China. I'm not launching the force. This is wrong. There was some sort of tensions with the Russians instead. And these are the sorts of ridiculous decisions which are being sent out from the high command. This is back in, whatever, 30, 40, 50 years ago from
the
United
States. Well, in actual fact, when we get to, I keep saying in actual fact, I must stop doing that. There must have been more incidents where we came close. We know about the Cuban Missile Crisis. We know about what happened in 1983. So all of those anti-nuclear demonstrators, you and me included, were right. The world nearly ended as a result of the belligerence and stupidity of the people in charge in the West. Because, of course, on the Soviet-Russian side, there was more rationality. They were just saying, let's just stick to intercontinental ballistic missiles. Let's keep short-range missiles out of it. Let's negotiate. Let's set up treaties. And, of course, the treaties were eventually set up. And now, in the last few years, they've all been ripped up whilst teenagers demonstrate against climate change. And there will be big climate change if there's a nuclear winter.
Anyway, so Boris Johnson, thankfully, is going to be in charge through all of this. Oh, my God. Anyway, it was at Prime Minister's Questions that Angela Eagle, for some reason, the Labour Party decided to give her the honour of asking a question about Boris Johnson and his just about squeaking in of the vote of confidence 2 days previously.
Dame Angela Riedel.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. May I associate myself with the Prime Minister's remarks about the importance of carers in our country. This week's events, Mr. Speaker, have demonstrated just how loathed this Prime Minister is. Yeah. And that's only in his own party. So, as his administration is too distracted by its internal divisions to deal with the challenges we face, can the Prime Minister explain, if 148 of his own backbenchers don't trust him, why on earth should the country?
Yeah! Prime Minister!
I thank the Right Honourable Lady very much for her question, and I can assure her that in a long political career so far, I have, of course, picked up, barely begun, I have, of course, picked up political opponents all over the place. And that is because this government has done some very big and very remarkable things which they did not necessarily approve of. And what I want her to know is that absolutely nothing and no one, least of all her, is going to stop us with getting on for delivering for the British people.
Well, it's the usual bluster, isn't it? That's all one can say. I think what will happen after the by-elections is there'll be another attempt to unseat him. And can I just make this point? In actual fact, the opposition parties were the biggest winners on the, this week, because the Tories continue in total crisis. And they have, if they keep Johnson, I'm afraid very conservative voters have taken a massive dislike to him. Because they're the ones who actually did obey the rules during the lockdown, the Captain Tom and all the rest of it, and he just looks as if he's the sort of person who doesn't care about any of that.
Well, although the media is very gung-ho for Ukraine and thinks that we should throw everything into the fight to help the Ukrainians, I'm not sure the vast majority of Conservative voters think that either.
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I think the support for the position on Ukraine is widespread, but it's shallow. People haven't really thought through the consequences of going to war with Russia.
And also, making the war last as long as possible doesn't seem to be particularly bright. Anyway, now on to staying with Prime Minister's questions. He's often a bit of a sort of curmudgeon and a bore, but he did quite well, the SNP's leader in Westminster, Ian Blackford, this week.
Mr. Speaker, week after week, I've called on this Prime Minister to resign. I've been met with a wall of noise from the Tory benches. I thought they were trying to shout me down, but all this time... But all this time, Mr. Speaker, it turns out that 41% of them have been cheering me on. Because, Mr. Speaker, let's be clear, at least the numbers don't lie. 41% of his own MPs have no confidence in him. 66 of MPs across the House don't support him. And 97% of Scottish MPs want the Minister for the Union shown the door. We now have a lame duck Prime Minister presiding over a divided party in a disunited kingdom. So how does the Prime Minister expect to continue when even unionist leaders in Scotland won't back them?
Prime Minister.
I want to thank my the Right Honourable Gentleman for his characteristic warm words. Actually, Mr. Speaker, I want to say that the biggest and most powerful and effective advocate of the United Kingdom over the last time that I've been in has been that man there. He's going to last here as leader of the SNP, the Scottish National Westminster. Long may he rest in place, Mr. Speaker. He is the Araldite that's keeping our kingdom together. I thank him for his
work.
Well, I can say to the Prime Minister. I can say to the Prime Minister that I'll be standing shoulder to shoulder with our First Minister as we take our country to independence. Speaker, the Prime Minister is acting like Monty Python's Black Knight, running around declaring it's just a flesh wound. And no amount of delusion and denial will save the Prime Minister from the truth. This story won't go away until he goes away. For once in his life, he needs to wake up to reality. Prime Minister, it's over. It's done. The Prime Minister has no options left, but Scotland does. Scotland has the choice of an independent future. Because it's not just the Prime Minister that we have zero confidence in. It's the broken Westminster system that puts a man like him in power. Can he tell us? Can the Prime Minister tell us how it is democratic that Scotland is stuck with a Prime Minister we don't trust, a Conservative Party we don't support, and Tory governments we haven't voted for since 1955.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we had a referendum, as I've told the House before, in 2014. I think he should respect the mandate of the people. And, you know, he keeps saying that he wants his independence for his country. Our country is independent, Mr. Speaker. Our country is independent. Then he tried 48 times to reverse it to the leader of the opposition. And the only way that independence would ever be reversed is if we had the disaster, Mr. Speaker, of a Labour-SNP coalition to take us back into the EU.
So that's Boris is really saying that that's what the Tories fear the most is this Labour SNP coalition, which I'm quite certain they've been discussing behind the scenes, surely.
Well, if you remember the way that they dealt with Ed Miliband, you know, if you remember him calling for windfall taxes on utilities, if you remember. But one of the ways they dealt with him is the coalition of chaos. A hung parliament would leave the SNP to be in charge of British politics. And, of course, that does have some... You know, there is such a condescending attitude in certain parts of England towards Scottish people that they really think... I mean, don't forget, one of the reasons why Brown had an undercurrent of hostility was because he wasn't one of us. And, you know, this is a fundamental problem. The English, a bit like the Serbs in Yugoslavia, they think they own the country. Mm. And, of course, in Scotland, that's very much resented.
Well, you think so? Well, why didn't they vote for independence then?
Because there's always going to be arguments in favour and against independence, whether you're in Ukraine or in or any other country, or Slovenia or Serbia or whatever.
Anyway, he's having a great laugh at Boris's expense, painting his picture of him as the Black Knight in denial about only flesh wounds. Do you think, you know, is this really going to affect Boris, this vote, do you think?
Yes. He's definitely weakened, even the Tory commentariat, and even those that support him recognise that he's been weakened. I tell you where the champagne corks were popping in Labour Party headquarters, because Boris carrying on as a damaged Prime Minister really puts the ball into the Tories' court. They've either got to get rid of him or they're going to go into the next election with him. But his personal opinion poll ratings are now dire.
Actually, also,
he's dragging his own party down.
Labour leader Keir Starmer, actually, also I thought did quite well this week with a particular point about slow death of the National Health Service to the benefit of the US healthcare industry.
Keir Starmer. Mr. Speaker, raising taxes because you failed to grow the economy isn't a plan for the NHS. Yeah. And everyone sitting behind him knows it. Members of his cabinet admit that Conservatives left our health system wanting and inadequate when the pandemic hit. Yeah. He's been in power for 3 years. And things are getting worse, not better. Fewer GPs, more waits for cancer tests, buildings still crumbling, and he's changing the rules to cover up his failure. And there is a real human pain as a result. Today I spoke to Hamza Semakula. Hamza is 20, and he plays semi-professional football for Hendon. He tore his ACL earlier this year. Because of the 2-year wait for surgery, he had to crowdfund for a private operation. I also spoke to Akshay Patel. Last year, his mother woke up unable to breathe. Akshay called 999 six times. In his last call, he said, "I rang an hour ago for an ambulance as she had difficulty breathing. And now she's dead." Even he must admit that Akshay, Bina and Hamza deserve better than a wanting and inadequate government utterly unable to improve our NHS.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I think everybody in the House has sympathy with Akshay and the other constituents and their families and the other constituents that he mentions, Mr. Speaker, and I share their feelings. But when you look at what this government is doing, the massive and I must say this to him, we are making colossal investments in our NHS. We are cutting waiting times. We're raising standards. We're paying nurses more. We're supporting our fantastic NHS. And by the way, he continually came to this. I don't just remind him of this and said that we had the worst COVID record in Europe. Turned out to be completely untrue. He still hasn't retracted it. We're doing it, Mr. Speaker. We can make those investments because of the strength of the UK economy, because of the fiscal firepower that we have to deploy. We have the lowest unemployment now since 1974, and we are going to continue to grow our economy for the long term. He asked about the mission of this government, Mr. Speaker. It is to unite and level up across our whole country, to unleash unleash the potential of our entire country. The biggest tutoring programme in history for young people, raising literacy and numeracy standards for 11-year-olds from 65% adequacy to 90%. That is the highest objective I think a government could achieve. Expanding home ownership for millions of people, as my right honourable friend for Duluth and I will do, for millions of people who currently don't have it. Cutting the costs of... No, cutting the costs of business to make this the enterprise centre of Europe. That is our vision. Creating high-wage, high-skilled jobs for this country. And as for jobs, I'm going to get on with mine, and I hope he gets on with his.
So, Boris Johnson there replying to a question about waiting times for ambulances with a sort of list of things he wants. Literacy to improve, numeracy to improve, more people to own their own homes. I'm not sure I believe any of that, but it certainly isn't going to help the National Health Service, any of that, is it?
No, well, I mean, he does what he normally does, which is he doesn't answer the question that he's been asked. And, of course, Starmer isn't really asking him a question either. It's an attempt to sort of, you know, it's like bear baiting, literally.
Well, this is not just one place where there's a, I mean, I hate to use the word crisis, but we just simply don't have enough ambulances since the whole system has been has, you know, sort of shoved into this sort of semi-privatised state, and the health services have been put into these trust organisations and
by a Labour government, which of course Boris Johnson could have picked up on if he was a different kind of Tory.
No, but he doesn't actually want to talk about what's going on at all. He wants to talk about something else. He just seems to have a little... Maybe he's got it on the written on the back of his hand, a list of five or six policies that the Conservatives have, and he doesn't actually answer the question.
What he does, which is very even worse, is that when he's in a political crisis, he comes up with wizard wheezes, like the idea of giving tenants on housing benefit the right to buy their social housing, which is absolutely unworkable rubbish. Even if it was to work, all it would do is reduce the amount of social housing. And of course, it can't be done because banks are not going to lend to people on benefits to buy their own housing, even with a 70% discount. And of course, because housing associations are separate from the government, they will have to be 100% compensated for that 70%.
This is a wizard wheeze, isn't it? This whole idea of using people on benefit to buy their own homes.
Well, yes, and no doubt that was something that was suggested in the Tory manifesto that Cameron wrote. But they looked into it and realised it's a non-starter for pretty obvious reasons. Poor people can't afford to buy their own homes. That's why they can't buy them.
That's just not true, though, is it? Because if you were to tot up the amount of housing benefit that people have paid for, you know, over decades and decades for a house, that would, you know, sometimes it's much more than the actual value.
Well,
but
that money goes to buy-to-let landlords. It doesn't go to the tenants, does it?
No. Well, that's what they're suggesting, I think, isn't it? That, you know, rather than the money go to a landlord, the money could go into some sort of a mortgage.
The housing associations, in theory, as you know, they've become more and more just commercial organisations, but in theory they're supposed to house people who find it difficult to get onto the property ladder. Now, by allowing that stock to be sold off, the point is that housing associations are independent of the government. They're independent of the local authorities. This is their assets, and the government is going to instruct them. This is supposedly a conservative free market government.
The reason the
government does to sell their own assets.
Well, speaking as a former director of a housing association, the reason the government does this is because much of the housing that they're building is financed by the government.
Yes, that's right, and it ought to be run by the government.
This is a quid pro quo here. You know, if we help you build these houses, we then have a say on how they're used.
Yeah, but if they're going to remain independent organisations, Bob Kerslake used to be the head of the civil service, writing the Guardian about this week. Then you've got to compensate. The housing associations don't want to sell off their stock. That's clear, but they're going to be told they've got to do it in theory. Although this is, don't forget, Boris hasn't discussed this with anybody.
Anyone actually wants to buy their own housing association place, as some of my neighbours have tried to do. Some managed to do it, but then afterwards, basically, what the housing association does is just says no. And if you're going to try and do it, then you're going to have to take the housing association to court in order to buy your own place.
Right. Well, housing associations have got charitable goals,
yeah,
like Peabody Trust. Trust in London was founded in the 1860s to house
poor people. I just think it's just another way of getting people into debt. That's what
of course it is. And
about.
Of course the other thing is, as I've stressed, they've got to give them a 70% discount on the price. Now, if the housing association is going to remain financially viable, that means the government has got to come up with that money. Yeah. Now, that means that we've got to either increase taxes or go to the magic money tree.
This is a way of supposedly getting around the housing crisis, as there's not enough homes for people in this country, the massive housing bubble. And this came up at Prime Minister's Questions too.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As my right honourable friend knows, Rochester and Strood is facing unrealistic housing targets, putting pressure on the council to bring forward a local plan that will close successful working docks and the loss of beloved open spaces such as Deangate Ridge, all in the name of meeting an arbitrary target. Can my right honourable friend assure my constituents who are facing this level of overdevelopment that there will be greater flexibility on housing numbers so that the council can produce a local plan that delivers the appropriate housing but protects important sites like these?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
I thank my honourable friend, and she speaks, I know, for colleagues up and down the country. We want to make sure that councils are able to build in the right place and sensitively to local needs, and that is what we insist on. But I just want to make it one thing absolutely clear. Part of the merit, the genius of levelling up, Mr. Speaker, is that it will encourage us to take some of the pressure, some of the heat out of the southeast of England, which has been overburdened for decades, and we can do it.
So, one of the getting rid of a lot of these housing and planning rules, Martin, has just simply meant that the Greenbelt is being ripped up. And as this lady MP there from Rochester and Strood is saying, that beautiful bits of the local area, which people rely on as sort of green lungs, are just simply being built on now, and plans are coming in for them to build these houses because, of course, buying that agricultural land is a lot cheaper for the house builders than, say, on a brownfield site.
Well, the idea that by having more houses, particularly more, upmarket houses, you're going to solve the housing crisis is simply wrong.
They're not upmarket, these, are they?
Well, I know,
once they're building for affordable housing, they've got no gardens. If they're detached, they've got about 6 inches between one house and the next. And usually the front doors are opening almost straight onto the road. So these are just the bare minimum, really.
Well, what they could be doing is compulsorily purchasing unused land in the inner
and
city
and unused buildings. A lot of the industrial places.
Why go to any greenfield site? And the other thing you can do in terms of levelling up is increase wealth and land taxes and spend it in the Isle of Skye, and then the money gradually comes from the Isle of Skye all the way back to London.
All of this really comes back to this wealth tax, doesn't it? We were talking about with Kevin Carhill a few weeks ago. The idea that the super rich just simply aren't paying absolutely no tax, your Bill Gates, etc. But anyway, I thought we'd just have a bit of a throwback to 1969. A journalist called Clive Gunnell, I'm not sure what channel he was working for, talks about the way houses used to be built many moons ago. And this one, the little village of Huckerby near Hexworthy in Dartmoor.
Most of the trees that once grew on these slopes have gone. Standing here on the heights above Hexworthy, looking down on the village of Huckerby that lies down there in the valley, it's difficult, in fact, almost impossible to see either a rooftop or a chimney. And sitting here in this field looking back up the slope towards where we've just been, it's impossible again to see the road where we were that twists and turns down here through Hexworthy, down here again to Huckerby. And this is the very reason why this cottage you see behind me in the background was built. This cottage is part of Dartmoor's tradition and it's part of Dartmoor's history. It is probably the last house to be built in one day in the whole of Great Britain. In 1832, there was a man called Tom Satterley who worked in what was then the Saracen's Head as an ostler, looked after the horses, but today it's called the Two Bridges Hotel. He had secretly married some weeks before a lady who was a serving maid in one of the houses around here, in probably a farmhouse, called Sally. They both wanted to get out of this kind of servitude, and it really was in those days. And there was just one faint chance they might do it. If they could build a house in a day. Now, they chose this site here for this attempt for two reasons. The first one I've just mentioned. Nobody coming down that hill could see them hidden down there behind this little hill. And the other reason was there's a little river that runs down the side there, and they would need that, of course, for their water supply. Now, tradition had it that the house had to be started at sunup, and it had to be completed with four walls, a roof, and smoke curling out of the chimney by sundown. And once you had built those four walls, you were not ever allowed to extend them. So obviously you built in as large an area as you could and just as high as you could possibly go with one story, because you could afterwards go on building up higher. And in fact, that cottage you can see now has been extended by the Duchy of Cornwall some years after it was built. And you also had to enclose around your cottage an area large enough to make you self-supporting. And to do this, you had to mark it out again with boulders. And they had to be big boulders, because there was a sort of standard height, which I think was about 18 inches, that they had to be. Once you had done this, of course, and you had been accepted, then all the common grazing rights that went with living here on Dartmoor became yours as well. You were, in fact, virtually a farmer. All you had to do then was to buy your stock over the years that came. It's rather wonderful to think of that scene as it must have been here on that midsummer's morning, as they crept down here and picked up all the logs that they had hidden away in these bushes, all the thatch that they'd covered over the weeks before so nobody would see them, and started to drag these great granite boulders, when this is what it must have been, a man and a woman, and laying them one on top of the other, and you can still see how uneven they are now at the bottom there, before they join the new bit of pointing. And working, their hands must have been raw, they must have been worn out, and just a few chosen friends who would come down with them. Of course, they chose Midsummer Day for another very good reason. Midsummer's Day was always the traditional ram roasting ceremony that went over in the village of Holme, and everybody went, absolutely everybody, all the children. So there was no little child who could wander down here and say, "Hello, what are you doing then?" and then scamper off home and say, "Hey, they're building a farm down there." So nobody, just Sally and Tom and a few friends who were going to help them build this home. And you can imagine them scurrying around here, dragging great boulders, putting them one on top of the other, dry stone that just had to stay there, balanced, laying the logs across the top, and then finally the thatch that went over and a little hole, lighting the fire as it came, the sun dipping down over the hill there and the smoke beginning to curl up through the top. And they'd done it. And as they were doing it, and as the smoke rose here, and the farmers came back over there on their horses, they saw this smoke, and they were all for riding over there and then and knocking the lot down and throwing them out. There was one farmer who farmed in those days at a farm, Sherberton, and he said, "Now, hold on a minute. These are unwritten laws on the moor, and if we break one of them, then everybody else has the right to come and break ours." And those laws, which then went back to the 12th century, but still were unwritten, the laws of common grazing, these kind of laws, they realised that if they destroyed this cottage here at Huckerby, they stood a very great chance of destroying all their own unwritten laws, some of which still survive to this day. And that is really why this little cottage here at Huckerby, which Sally and Tom Satterley built in a day, is a very important part indeed of Dartmoor history. And by the way, if you would like to read more about this story, there is a rather wonderful book, Genesis Down. It's written by Dartmoor writer Vian Smith, and it really does dramatise the story of Tom and Sally Satterley. And I think it would be very well worth your while to get hold of a copy.
So that's Clive Gunnell, a reporter for something that some people may remember called Westwood Television. It was part of Associated Red Fusion. It must have been their franchise around here before HTV popped up, Harlech Television popped up on the scene. But anyway, Martin, interesting, isn't it? I mean, this is the way things used to be done, is you can build, if you can build a cottage in a day, you can stay there.
Well, these, as he said, are to do with the unwritten laws of Dartmoor. So you've actually got, and don't forget the Duchy of Cornwall is almost like a separate state. We've in Britain, you know, there were lots of local rights that people had. And it just depends on what the rules are. And also, of course, on what the balance of power is between the local landowners and the others.
That cottage, let me just take a wild guess. Is something like £800,000-£900,000 if you wanted to buy it. Back in those days, it's a bunch of your mates and just put it up in a day and that's it.
Yeah, presumably they have to improve it a bit. The basic stuff goes up in a day.
Yeah, and a chimney, etc. And so there's some complete and utter mismatch in housing. It seems as if housing is the only thing that people can, or the country can make money out of anymore. And it's incredibly expensive. Something like 95% of the money, which is going in either in rent or in mortgage repayments, is going to the land price, not the actual building itself. But, I mean, he's the key thing, I suppose, in that, lovely report from Westwood Television there from 1969 is this whole idea of it's a way out of servitude. Once you've got a house, you don't have to work in the big manor house anymore. You can, you're your own person. This is actually an essential kind of aspect of individual freedom, isn't it?
Well, land reform has been an issue in this country for hundreds of years, and it's a major issue in a developing world. The Communist Party of China basically destroyed the existing landholding system in their country, and many of the landowners who were supporters of the Kuomintang ended up dead. It's a very big issue, and it's a big issue in Latin America. It's a big issue all over the world. And when people talk about we need small holdings and we need sustainable agriculture, yes, I agree with that, but you're going to have to fight the landowners and their armies for it, and they're well-armed. And you better be armed better
than
that.
Well, I'm not sure that nobody had to shoot them to anybody to build this cottage, did they?
No, and in actual fact, that's why we're still in a situation where the landowners still run this country. The landowners in this country weren't dealt with as summarily as the landowners in China, were they?
No. Okay, so how is something going to be done about this complete mismatch between how much a house costs to buy or to rent and how much it costs to build?
Well, I would suggest land value taxation. And that means that the money that's made, you know, basically nationalisation of land. And that doesn't mean that the government runs it all.
Well, that's very different to taxing land, isn't it? If you tax land, I mean, people that have got it then suddenly have to use it to make more and more money out of it, don't they?
Well, you could nationalise it.
And as you know, I don't know if you know, but in parts of, I think it's in Hong Kong or... Oh gosh, parts of China, Hong Kong, Kowloon, maybe it is, where because land value tax is so high over there that what they've ended up is just massive tower blocks with loads of tiny little pigeon holes things for people to live in because the land tax is so high.
Yes, because that's the land tax going to the local government. The alternative is for those rents to go to local landowners. And they then become the local bosses.
As soon as you start taxing land for even small amounts, I mean, we were talking about this the other week, weren't we? With the Labour Party's wizard wheeze to stop people passing on their own homes. As soon as you start taxing, I mean, you know, you've got people with vast fortunes stashed in accounts abroad aren't being taxed at all, and somebody with a terraced house being taxed to such an extent they can't pass that house on. I mean, surely housing is something almost sacred. Once you've bought that, that's yours. Otherwise, what's the point in bothering?
As long as everybody only gets one, Tony. Of course, why should anybody have two when other people have only got one?
Well, that's right. Homes, of course, are not necessarily the same, are they?
No, they're not.
Yeah, they should be taxed. That's
out of existence,
surely. Yeah, quite possibly, yeah. But the problem is you've got lots and lots of people now who are paying rent. Actually, the idea really, what you want at the end of the day is for them to have their own place. If they've paid for that house twice over in rent, why shouldn't they have it? You really have got a thing about home ownership. You don't think people should own their own homes?
No, I'm not against home ownership, Tony.
You are.
I'm not.
So if you've paid through over a few decades twice the value of your house in rent, why shouldn't you own it?
I'm not opposed to home ownership. But the fact is, you've got to have a balanced policy. Some people, if you're going to have a capitalist society with a differential in wages necessary for efficiency, a bottom third of the population cannot afford their own homes. They have to rent. But those rents need to be kept down, as Michael Hudson pointed out, so that their wages can be kept relatively down, so that you can be competitive in the world market. Basically, what happens when the Duke of Westminster makes loads of money from owning Central London year in, year out, that money should go to the government to pay for the National Health Service. It goes into his pocket so he can buy the Tory party to carry on doing what we do.
Well, Prince Charles is the current Duke of Cornwall, the Duchy of Cornwall. We were hearing about there apparently owning that property. I'm not sure if they still do. I mean,
well, there you are. So in
actual
fact, they built it, and who owns it?
Well, maybe the duchy bought it off of them somehow. But Prince Charles is the current Prince of Wales. Is current boss of the Duchy of Cornwall. I suppose he's the Duke of Cornwall too, isn't he? Before that, it was Edward VIII, the Nazi. He was the King of the United Kingdom and Dominions of the British Empire and Emperor of India from the 20th of January 1936 until his abdication. So he was the previous Duke. I suppose this is the idea, is that the Duchy of Cornwall is there for the heir to the throne. It's a nice little nest egg to provide them with plenty of dosh. So anyway, fascinating, I thought. Very interesting piece. It'd be interesting to see if we can get more from that Clive Gunnell, the reporter from West Country, to find out a little bit more about life here in the west of England over the next few weeks. But anyway, back now to today and the sad announcement last week of the death of Roger Yates, who's a writer here in Bristol and a saxophonist. I thought we'd have another clip with him because they've announced now the date of the memorial here at the Bear Pit for Roger. So here he is talking a bit more to me a few years ago, back in 2015, in fact, about his book called The Beautiful Season, which is about, this particular clip is about his inspiration from George Orwell's book Homage to Catalonia for writing his book.
Let's quote Orwell, because everybody respects and trusts him. Orwell said, "The anarchists chased Franco out of Aragon." He was there shortly afterwards. He was amazed. Completely informed, in my view, the rest of his life. Orwell was an anarchist. And he was completely amazed at what he saw and heartwarmed by what he saw going on in Barcelona, which was really slightly after the High Period.
Did any of these ideals last after the Spanish Civil War?
No. I mean, okay. Some people were fighting Franco. Anarchists never gave up. They were in the hills. They fought Franco until, I think, 1967. So that was going on. Some of the ideals translated across to, for example, free school education. The modern schools of Paco Ferrer were created also in America, and I suppose Summerhill, the free school, has got a lot to do with that. The feminism of the Spanish Revolution, an organization called Mujeres Libres, Free Women. They were very, very advanced people, and we've forgotten about it.
What about the Pyrenees? Because I imagine that some of the sorts of ideals and ways of doing things, ways of working, might survive there. It's a little bit away from the cities and a little bit uncontrolled.
I don't think so. I think Franco really thoroughly obliterated that revolution. I do think that it possibly was the last chance for revolution in our society or in our history. I don't want to be too negative about
what
things.
Would you say were the lessons in terms of ideas, the positive ideas that came out of all that?
Well, the notion of anarchism is that you run society from the bottom without a state, without a party, through civil society organizations, specifically in Spain. These were through big trade unions. So after the revolution drove the army out, people simply went back to work. They then negotiated with the bosses. A lot of them ran away to France, but some of them stayed to say, well, okay, it's fine, you can stay, you get equal pay with everybody else, we have meetings about this, and it worked fine. People say, you know, don't be under the impression that the Spanish Revolution failed because it was an idealistic utopia and those kind of things never worked. I mean, how long it would have worked is another matter, because Spain was a divided society. I suppose over 50% of the people had anarchist ideals, and they would probably have won an election. But it's very difficult to change things. But
would it be difficult to persuade them to vote in an election as their anarchists?
Well, they had voted. They voted in some elections, they didn't vote in others. All of that was decided through meetings that were structured federally from the bottom up, and huge meetings, you know, of the trade unions, of the Senate. It was very democratic. It worked. Agricultural production went up by 30%. When the Bolsheviks, shall we call them, the communists, who are basically the bourgeoisie, agricultural production went up, industrial production improved. Ford's in Barcelona was retooled to make aircraft engines. The railways ran. The hospitals worked. Everything worked. If you don't believe me, read Orwell.
I'll just ask a question, first of all. Is this Roger, the Roger I know from Radical History in Bristol? Is that the guy? Is a different guy? Because I think the Roger who's involved in Radical History in Bristol will probably share many of those views. So I'm just wondering if it was him.
You mean Roger Ball?
Ah, yeah. Okay.
This is Roger Yates, died a few weeks ago.
Right. So it's not the same person.
Yeah, anyway. So what do you make of his take on the Spanish Civil War? He calls it the Spanish Revolution, his book, The Beautiful Season.
Well, I'm very familiar with this analysis because in my late teens and early 20s, I was absolutely fascinated by the anarchist role in the Spanish Civil War, like many of my generation. We were turned on to the idea of anarchism by Johnny Rotten, and then we started looking into it. We found it was a fascinating history that we just weren't taught in school. So it was really worth learning about. But subsequently, I've carried on taking an interest in it over the years. And I think there's an element of mythologizing. Because Franco won, the things that might have gone wrong with it in terms of how it functioned never really became apparent, because they were in power for a while, and it was actually Orwell talks in Homage to Catalonia of how the people who were serving in the bars and so on in Barcelona wouldn't accept tips because they felt it was demeaning, and that there was a huge cultural change going on. But ultimately, of course, as he pointed out, the Francoists and their allies won the Civil War.
Well, one of the most interesting things about the Civil War was the collectivisation of land, wasn't it?
Well, what happened in the south of Spain, in Andalusia, is you've got very big latifundia, which were great big plantation-style farms owned by big landowners. And they were chased out. And, of course, they then collectivised what they were doing. But in other parts of Spain, where you've got lots of smallholders, particularly you mentioned the Pyrenees earlier, you've got lots of smallholders there, land wasn't collectivised. Yeah, it was very much in the south.
I think, isn't it, Ken Loach's film Land and Freedom deals with this
yes, but
and all the politics of it too. But yeah. One of the things he talks about there was these arguments going on in villages, saying, well, you know, I've looked after this land for generations, someone was saying. And then someone piped up and said, actually, no, it's my family that have been looking after this land for you for generations, and now we want to collectivise it. It's not your land, well, it's everyone in the village's land. So the idea was what they were basically getting rid of the landlord class.
Yes, well, don't forget, anarchism was also quite powerful in Spain because the central government didn't do anything for anybody. The only time you saw the central government was when the Guardia Civil would turn up to shoot strikers dead. And don't forget, these big landowners in the south had been in a constant battle with the braceros, as they called them, the arms. Yeah, they were the hands, as we would say, and that's what they called them. And they were the workers on the land, and the land was virtually all of it owned by big landowners. And of course, in the Spanish Civil War, the big landowners were driven out. They took over the land. They organised themselves into collectives, not in a top down way, in a bottom up way. But of course, the Falangists then turned up and killed everybody associated with it unless they ran away. And that, unfortunately, is the problem.
And Roger's memorial is being held at the Bear Pit here in Bristol. For anyone that would like to come along, please do feel free. The more the merrier. At 2 p.m. on Saturday week. That's Saturday the 18th of June. Bring along drink and music. That's the idea. So that's Roger Yates' memorial, 2 p.m. at the Bear Pit here in Bristol, which is otherwise known as the James Barton Roundabout at the bottom of the Gloucester Road, right next to the coach station and the bus station here in Bristol. James Barton Roundabout, 2 p.m. Saturday the 18th of June. That's Saturday week. Bring drink and music. Yeah, I think actually Land of Freedom is one of Ken Loach's best films, along with Kez. Some of the other stuff has been a little bit flaky over the years, but it absolutely brilliant to see, you know, a little bit of history. And I remember chatting to some Spanish person about that when it came out. It must have been around the late 1990s, I think, saying, well, isn't it a pity that a Brit has to make a film about our history? But I suppose that's normal, isn't it?
Well, yeah, don't forget there were decades of Francoist dictatorship, well, that's right. So you couldn't make a film about it.
Anyway, on to Ukraine, and let's get stuck into Paul Mason's covert intelligence, the link to plot to destroy the grey zone exposed. Now, this is the former economics correspondent on the BBC on Newsnight, Paul Mason. Leaked emails reveal British journalist Paul Mason plotting with an intel contractor to destroy the grey zone through relentless deplatforming and a full nuclear legal attack. The scheme is part of a wider planned assault on the UK left. Former Trotskyist and BBC journeyman journalist Paul Mason has made a career as the establishment's favourite gatekeeper of the UK left. Well, that's not quite true. He made his career actually doing some decent economic commentary on Newsnight, and he's since branched out into other things. Since the Russian military incursion into Ukraine, he's cemented his position of one of Britain's most vocal left cheerleaders for Western military intervention. Well, that's certainly true. While leading a UK left delegation to Kiev and a demonstration through the streets of London in support of NATO military escalation against Russia, Paul Mason accordingly used his platform to assail journalists, academics, Labour Party members and private citizens who oppose shipping piles of advanced weaponry to Ukraine. In a series of recent columns, Paul Mason has called for the state-enforced suppression of facts and perspectives he considers overly sympathetic to the Kremlin, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two levels to this. One is Paul Mason's official position of supporting the Ukrainian war effort, opposing the Russian policy, and so on, which is well known. I mean, there is clearly a big split on this on the left, and he's definitely on that side of the divide. But what these leaked emails show is that he's prepared to work with intelligence services in order to discredit other journalists who don't agree with him. And of course, George Orwell, the sainted George Orwell, also handed over loads of names and addresses of people he knew on the left who he thought were communists. And he cooperated with the intelligence services, the British intelligence services. And of course, George Orwell went to Eton and was rather privileged, actually. He wasn't really a poor person.
Well, no one said he was a poor person, Martin. It's just that he used his privilege, unlike so many, for the benefit of the poor.
Yes, but at the same time, Orwell also had many faults as a writer and as a political activist. That doesn't mean that I'm not influenced by him. We all are. But there's a tendency for people, and the same with the anarchists in the Civil War also carried out various atrocities against the right as they saw it. I mean, that was one of the things they did, which the more mainstream socialist Republicans balked at.
So what do you make of Mason working along with the intelligence services? This is what this is implying, and private security, effectively. In a series of recent columns, Mason called, as I said, for the state-enforced suppression of facts and perspectives he considers sympathetic to the Kremlin, and demanded state action against members of the media that oppose the NATO line on Ukraine. He placed the grey zone at the top of his fantasy censorship target list. Well, it's not necessarily a fantasy, because there's a lot of money behind this, and potentially legal action to destroy the grey zone. Mason has since announced a run for Parliament on the Labour ticket to wage his crusade against disinformation from inside the House of Commons. The grey zone, meanwhile, learned through anonymously leaked emails and documents that he's been engaged in a malicious secret campaign that aims to enlist the British state and friendly intelligence cutouts to undermine, censor and even criminalise anti-war dissenters. In one leaked email, Paul Mason thundered for the relentless deplatforming of the grey zone and the creation of a kind of perpetual rebuttal operation to discredit it. In another, he said, the far-left rogue academics is who I'm after. Then he rants, that must be people like Kees van der Peel, then, who was on this show a few weeks ago, then rants that he's motivated by fear of an emergent left anti-imperialist identity, which will be attractive because liberalism doesn't know how to counter it. He also talked about trying to destroy the grey zone through legal actions. What is it he's got against Max Blumenthal?
Well, what he's got, his politics, Mason's politics, are...
He's not winning the argument, so he's trying to destroy the people that are actually winning that argument against him on the left.
That's right. And the way he's presenting it, it's because all these people are actually evil crypto-communists, coming back to the earlier stuff we were saying about CND. I think a lot of his stuff is interesting, I would say. I've read his books and, I follow some of the stuff he does. But he's always been one foot in, one foot out of the establishment.
So do you think he's having a relationship with the intelligence services, and the intelligence services are now, persuaded him that, that he should just be simply a, collaborator with them in destroying people that they don't agree with?
Well, looking at that article which I sent you, I think the fact is that he's basically, he imagines himself to be in charge, and he wants MI5 to wreck. The Grey Zone, of course, is based in the United States of America. So it's
that would potentially be legal action against them in the States. This is an absolutely appalling thing for anybody, to so-called journalists, to do, to say, well, we're losing an argument against these people. They seem to be doing very well. Lots of people believe them. So let's destroy them.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is the whole concept of information warfare, isn't it? And I think we saw similar splits over the situation in Yugoslavia in the 90s.
By the way, he replied to it all, and he didn't actually deny any of the
emails. No, because the emails are clearly.
And he's now saying, oh, well, obviously they're working with the Russians. The Russians must have spied.
Well, that's what the Grey Zone are accusing. When they get access to this material, it's clearly, it must have been hacked by the Russians, just like the Democratic National Computers. He buys into all of this stuff. Yeah, that the Russian secret services hacked the Democrat National Computers, even though all the evidence shows that it was a leak by Seth Rich, who ended up dead. Now, this is the problem.
Information warfare going on in the Ukraine conflict in order to try and bolster the Ukrainian army. How do you think things are going on the ground down there? It looks as if, is it Severodonetsk, which is the main source of fighting? It looks as if the Russians are closing in around the back of the Ukrainian army there, in a kind of pincer movement.
Well, obviously, I read a lot about this stuff, because I may be asked to go on RT to comment on it, although I haven't been for the last few weeks. Not least because I can't even get RT on my internet now.
You need to get a Tor browser, by the way. Well, that's what you just download a Tor browser. That will, you can. Okay. It's what they had to do in China when they started censoring the internet there.
All right. Well, anyway, the point is, I do follow it quite closely.
Your beloved China.
Yes. Well, I try to follow all these things as closely as I can, given the time I have. I think the obvious thing to point out, just in a general sort of way, rather than going into lots of nitty-gritty detail, is that the Ukrainian army is in the wrong place. It was sent to try and suppress what was the breakaway republics, and therefore is a completely the wrong place to defend Kiev. And that's exactly what
the Russians aren't really targeting Kiev.
No, that's right. The Russians didn't want to go to Kiev. They only went towards Kiev to pin down with the forces that were there, so that they couldn't reinforce the Donbass. And what the Ukrainians should have done, if from a military point of view, is to withdraw from the two breakaway republics and then defend further west.
Anyway,
which of course would allow the Russians to win without a fight.
The CIA.
But what's happened now? They're now inside the pocket, and Zelensky himself admits they're losing at least 200 a day. Other estimates say they're losing 500 troops a day, and they're being ground to powder. That's what's happening.
So once the Donbass, the Russians, it does look as if, over months or weeks, the Russians will finally take over the whole of the Donbass. Do you think they'll stop there?
I think what they're going to do when they've done that is the West needs to think, this is what Kissinger was saying at Davos, we need to start talking to the Russians now, because if we don't, they're going to carry on. And the Russians are going to say, you don't have to talk to us, we want to talk to you, but if you don't talk to us, we're going to carry on until we want to stop. If you want us to stop, you better talk to us and talk to us about what we're going to do
anyway,
about it.
I think one of the most interesting figures in the whole of this conflict is get no coverage at all, of course, by the BBC, who don't take any notice of anything useful, including the death of one of the greatest peace campaigners in British post-war history, Bruce Kent, this week, which we covered at the beginning of the programme. Is this guy Viktor Pinchuk? He is the Masonic Grand Master in Ukraine. He's also worked very, very closely with the CIA and people like Victoria Nuland over the years. He's the number one oligarch over there. He's a dual Ukrainian-Israeli citizen. He was down at Davos, of course, he would be, wouldn't he, at the World Economic Forum last week. And here is the great Viktor Pinchuk, his pitch to the world's economic powerhouse at Davos, all about what he wants to do in Ukraine.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you very much for joining us. This year, World Economic Forum, this year, Davos is Ukrainian Forum, Ukrainian Davos.
The point being that these oligarchs are really running the show. I mean, it is an oligarchy. It's not a democracy. It's not a sovereign country. It's controlled by the Americans.
Are you talking about the Ukraine or Great Britain? Obviously, the Ukraine is an oligarchy. I mean, everybody talks about it as an oligarchy. Oligarchic politics, it dominates the Ukraine. Zelensky is a creature of Kolomoisky. But Kolomoisky, Pinchuk, Poroshenko, Timoshenko. Timoshenko is a politician, but she's also the politician's become wealthy. I mean, it looks like Zelensky's worth millions, even though he was worth nothing before he became the president. Go figure what's going on there. This has always been the way in the Ukraine. The Ukraine carried on being the kind of bespredel, which means no rules capitalism, which in Russia was brought under control just about in the 2000s. And there's a big difference between the two countries now in terms of their organisation. Michael Hudson would say, well, you know, the Russians have started, you know, even United Russia are talking about we've got to nationalise everything that we don't...
I mean, we are talking here about a kind of new world order, aren't we, where individual nations are being remote controlled, really, by the Central Intelligence Agency, by the banks, by the Bilderbergers in many ways. And actually, they're not really, even though, of course, they go on and on and on the BBC about how this is a sovereign country. It's not, is it? And the actual reality is that these two systems, as Michael Hudson has been explaining over the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks, are really at loggerheads. So you've got individual nations are saying, no, we're not going to be subsumed into any kind of new world order. And I noticed someone tweeted to me, I'm not sure who it was, thank you very much if it was you, the former Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad talking about the Bilderbergers and these elites and what exactly the new world order is, a conference in Malaysia about the new world order a couple of years ago.
Malaysia's former Prime Minister Dr. Mahathir Mohamad said that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPPA, is a new world order strategy by a powerful pact of people led by the US to dominate the world economy. Speaking at the international conference titled New World Order, Recipe for Peace or War, organized by the Perdana Global Peace Foundation, Dr. Mahathir said globalization and borderless trade are being used to establish a one world government.
Basically, it is about having a world government. We should abolish all states, all nations, all borders, but instead have only one world government. And that world government is to be by certain people, elites, people who are very rich, very intelligent, very powerful in many ways. They are the ones who will govern the world. There was not much talk about democracy or choice of leaders. Instead, there was to be a government by these elites who will impose their rules on everyone in this world. And for those who are unwilling to submit to them, there will be punishment. And the peace that we will get from this is the peace of the graveyard, because the intention also is to reduce the number of people in this world. At the time when the New World Order was enunciated, The population of this world was only 3 billion. The intention was to reduce it to 1 billion. Now the population of the world is 7 billion. There will be a need to kill many billions of people or to starve them to death or to prevent them from giving birth in order to reduce the population of this world.
So that's the former Malaysian Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, MAHATHIRMOHAMAD, Mahathir Mohamad, at a conference in March 2015, international conference entitled The New World Order, A Recipe for War or Peace? Question mark. Actually, no, it's an exclamation mark at the end of it. He believes, Martin, that the elites want to reduce the world's population by fair means or foul.
I think that's clearly an issue that people need to confront. The wealthy elites in the West, the least you could say is they don't care what happens to the people at the bottom of the pile. But some of them want to go further than that. I mean, as Prince Philip famously said, when I'm dead, I want to be reincarnated as a deadly virus.
But wasn't he joking?
No, he wasn't joking, sadly.
Yes, I think he was.
No, I don't think he was, right. Tony. That's right. The problem.
Okay, well, this whole idea of a new world order, you do admit or agree that there is something out there that is pushing for this and that is involved in this Ukraine war, etc., etc. How can you sum up this concept of a new world order?
Well, I think the problem with using the word new world order is that it means different things to different people.
George Bush used the word.
Yes,
didn't
I know.
He?
Yes, and lots of people use it. It was originally used by the Nazis. You know, so therefore that's why it has this kind of connotation.
Yeah. We could call it a new order. There was a pop band, wasn't
yes,
it?
Which, yeah, that's right. And then, the point is, it doesn't really matter what we call it.
Really.
What it is quite straightforward to understand. It's the wealthy elites in the Western, you know, that dominated the global economy since Columbus discovered America. They have dominated the world. They've enslaved the world. That's literally what they did. Then the slaves are released, but of course the power structures remain the same. Africa still sends most of its wealth year in, year out as tribute to Wall Street and the City of London. People in developing countries, particularly in Latin America, we've got a very militant tradition, are very well aware of the way the world works, that we work hard and you take it all off us at gunpoint. And of course, nobody's been able to stop them until now. Because what's happening in the Ukraine, and of course what happened in Syria, is suddenly the bullies got a couple of punches in the face.
So in Ukraine particularly, the Russians, you think, are saying, no, you're not going to have it all your own way.
Absolutely. And of course, what they've done, they realise that, you know, Mao Zedong used to talk about... it doesn't matter if there's a world war, millions will die, but at least socialism will triumph, which is pretty mad. But of course, in those days, the Chinese army trained the Zimbabwean African National Army in Mozambique, and they fought a hard-fought guerrilla war inside what was then Rhodesia, and they won it. And of course, all around the world, the Soviet Union was also... The Cubans went to Quitaquinavale in Angola and defeated the South African army. All of these things were going on in the 70s. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we're suddenly back to unipolar world order. But it's breaking down.
Do you think the West can win in this battle of ideologies between the NATO countries and Russia at the moment? Do you think it can win against Russia and China militarily, or will it just simply be a question of wearing people down in an economic fashion? I mean, it's interesting the way he then talked about these powerful people want to dominate the world economy. Well, they seem to be doing quite well at that. They don't need to have a war, do they?
Well, the war and the domination of the world economy using economic sanctions and so on is the war. Yeah, it's been going on for quite a while. When did the Second World War start? We say 1939, but the Chinese invaded Manchuria in 1935 and the Spanish Civil War was part of the Second World War. It was earlier. So we're in that sort of phase.
Well, we are now. Yeah. I would call it a Fourth Reich where we are now, which is an economically very, very powerful economic war.
I've just put a caveat on that, because what's very interesting about what's happened is that the Germans are being shown what their real role in the world is. If the German Nazis and Bormann now were watching what the American Anglo-Americans and the Jews in Israel are doing to Germany, he would be rolling in his grave in Argentina. Because, of course, German industry is now going to be smashed, not in order to help defeat Russia, but to help Wall Street. And ultimately, of course, that's what happens when you lose world wars. The same with Japan. They're going to be pushed forward to fight China.
Martin, Yuval Noah Harari had something to say about Germany.
As historians, we are constantly aware of the centrality of the past in shaping the present, in shaping the future. And, you know, I would like to say to Germans, German politicians and Germans in general, as a historian, as a Jew, as an Israeli, we know that you are not Nazis. You don't need to keep proving it again and again. You don't need to be afraid that if you pick up a gun or that if you raise your voice, we will think that you are Nazis. We know you are not. What we need from Germany is to stand tall and lead. This is now the leader of Europe. If you really want to make amends for the crimes of the Nazi era, it's not by being neutral. It's not by standing aside. You should be at the forefront of the fight for freedom, for democracy. This will be the best atonement for the crimes of the Nazi period.
So I look forward to the German army taking on the British and the Americans, because they're the ones who are the New World Order, not the Russians. The Russians and the Germans should work together to smash NATO.
Well, what he's saying there is he's trying to egg them on to lead the Germans against Russia.
Yes, and that's where this is the problem, isn't it? The Germans are going to be asked to make big sacrifices so that the Americans, the British and the Israelis can defeat the Russians. But it's not in Germany's national interest, as people like Schröder, who of course opposed Germany's involvement in the Iraq war quite correctly and is on the board of Gazprom. He used to be the Chancellor. Germany.
He said, "No, that's Nord Stream 2. He's on the board."
Yes, but he's on the board of various other companies. In actual fact, it makes perfect sense for a democratic Germany with a mixed economy to work closely with democratic Russia, to develop the socialist industrial capitalism, which the British, Americans and the Israelis don't like to see.
Germany, Martin, is being very much pulled in two directions. Which way will they fall, do you think?
I think at the moment, because of all of this guilt tripping by people like Hariri from Israel, a state which possibly shouldn't exist at the end of World War III.
He's not guilt tripping them. He's saying just look, you can be stand confidently now.
Yeah, yes. And if they were standing confidently, they'd be saying, we're not putting sanctions on Russia. That's what a confident Germany would be doing.
Anyway, winding up tonight with the final of our several clips. And this is, the first one was about Ivan Fraser and David Icke, David Icke being the fake Ivan Fraser. And now the fake Bill Cooper, a guy called Alex Jones. Let's hear from the original, real Bill Cooper.
Here's the way they look at it. Here's their metaphor for the end of innocence. Adam and Eve were held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust, cruel, and vindictive God. Until Lucifer, through his agent Satan, set man free from this garden by giving him the gift of intellect. Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land, every secret brotherhood, every secret society,
Every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy. They do not believe in Lucifer. They do not believe in any entity called a devil, and they do not believe in God. It is a mistake for you to assume that they do. They are atheists in the strictest sense of the word. They are humanists. That's their religion. At the highest level, their goal is to create a world in which the adepts, the thousand points of light, working behind the veil to create the culmination of the great plan, can realize the ultimate happiness for mankind.
So that's the fake, that's not the fake anyone. That is the real Bill Cooper, what I call Alex Jones, the fake Bill Cooper. He is talking there about the Luciferian atheists and his Lansing, Michigan lecture back from 1996 to wind us up this evening. And thank you very much, Bill. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Guardian journalist and comedy writer Charlie Skelton and sound engineer Dave Bazenko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, or if you like, on Twitter by putting my @TonyGosling handle in there. You'll also find on the show page, though, the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. That's at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in the UK today, thanks to the Nazi collaborators who own some of the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
your hands into your hands. And then the smiles cover your heart. Baby, I'm with you. Strange. Strange.